This is the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance Committee. Today is Wednesday, March 11th. Representative Simonson moves approval of the minutes dated March 4th. Is there any discussion? March 4th? When we do the 9th? Okay. Well, we're not going to approve the minutes then. Representative Keel, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 894 be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. Representative Keel, to your presentation. And to our testifiers and all our testifiers today, we have a very robust agenda for the committee today. So if you could just be brief, but of course we want to hear from you. So Representative Keel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. This bill deals with the border cities along Minnesota, actually the Red River and extended south of there, and it involves five qualifying cities: Breckenridge, Dilworth, East Grand Forks, Moorhead, and Ortonville. The intent of this, and this has been a program for some time now, but the intent of this is to provide predictable and sustainable, it's a sustainable program that will retain and create jobs and has been very successful. In the interest of the agenda today, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to ask both of my testifiers to talk about how successful it's been in their communities.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Hutchins, Deputy City Manager of the City of Moorhead, Minnesota. Thank you, and I'll be brief. There is a packet that you have before you that gives a bit of the history of the Border Cities program, a program that was established some years ago after an analysis by the then Economic Development Department of the state of Minnesota that pinpointed the effects of these cities' proximity, contiguous location to cities, in this case in North Dakota, at the time. The program has certainly served its purpose well over the years, halted an exodus of business out of our communities, and retained a business as well as create jobs. It's an economic development program that works very, very well. We're entering a new phase, we believe, of our relationship on the border with our neighbors to the west, given certain events occurring in the state of North Dakota, and Representative Keel's bill is designed to address some of those issues as we move forward. And by the way, you'll note some of the indicators of continued economic distress are in your packet, located toward the latter part of the packet, that you can look at when you have an opportunity. And I'll turn it over to David Murphy, Administrator of the City of East Grand Forks, who will speak a bit about East Grand Forks' experience in using the Border City program.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is David Murphy. I am the East Grand Forks City Administrator. And in respect for the time, I'll be very brief. Historically, since roughly 1998, we have used the Border Cities Tax Credit to, for the most part, keep Minnesota businesses that have started in East Grand Forks, to keep them from, when they are expanding or looking for new sites, from actually crossing over to the river to Grand Forks. We are excited for the possibilities that we have for the future here now with the Grand Forks Air Force Base. A portion of that is being repurposed for an industrial and commercial park to support the unmanned aircraft, both in the military use and the civilian use of that. So there are several companies that will be locating actually on that repurposed portion on the base that requires security clearance, those type of things. But there will be many support businesses that will be feeding those that do not require this the security clearance, so they can locate anywhere. So we are looking at utilizing this to make sure that we get our share of that over onto this cross river over on our side, so in East Grand Forks. So thank you.
Great. Representative Keel, did you have any other invited testimony for the presentation?
I don't believe so.
Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and move to member questions and comments. Members? I'll just say the chair is a big fan of this, and I understand the shale gas revolution that's taking place in North Dakota. The energy portion of this committee totally understands the economic benefits to North Dakota, but also the barriers and the to progress that take place for border communities. I'm a big fan of this bill, and happy to move this bill for support today. So with that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 894 recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes, Representative
Thank
Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members?
Thank you.
Good job, Captain. Representative Kreshaw. Chair will move House File 593 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And Representative, here we go. There are, first of all, do you have any author's amendments you'd like the committee to move, Representative Kreshaw, or do you want the chair to determine which amendments to move?
I prefer the chair, Mr. Chair.
Okay, members, there are, I see three amendments in here. Each of them do the same thing. They increase the appropriation from $50 million to either $60 million, $80 million, or $180 million. So first of all, who's the author of the A6 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
I think most of these amendments are mine, and it's my intention, if you're willing, to only introduce one of them, and I think Representative Johnson may introduce another one, depending on what happens.
All right, Representative Simonson, you want to go ahead and move the A6 amendment then?
Mr. Chair, actually, I would like to move the A15, if it's all right with you.
All right. I do not have an A15 amendment in my packet, Representative Simonson. I have a A15-0167. Is that the one you're referring to?
Mr. Chair, let's try the A15-0167.
Representative Simonson moves A15-0167. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my amendment would simply add a subsequent appropriation in the second year of the biennium of another $50 million. And without getting into lengthy debate about the value of broadband across our state, I think that it's important to notice, and you know, Representative Kreshaw will probably speak to this as well, but I think it's important to just talk about a little bit about the return on investment and these investments into broadband. And as I worked on this over the last 2 years quite a bit, I did get an opportunity to hear from a lot of folks across the state about how important it actually is, and really ended up focusing on economic development trends and what the future of those trends were in Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, where there is oftentimes a lack of adequate access to broadband. And I think my amendment would simply add, simply being a relative term, another $50 million in the subsequent year. But it does still fall far short of the recommendation from the task force recommendations on broadband to the governor. So, Mr. Chair, without any further belaboring the point, I'll just offer that amendment.
Well, members, we do not have a target for this committee yet, but there's nothing wrong with dreaming big. Representative Kreshaw, do you have any opposition to this amendment?
I have no opposition, Mr. Chair.
Right. Any additional discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The A15-0167 amendment is adopted. We have three other amendments in our packet, A6, A5, and A7. Would the author of the A6 amendment wish to speak to that?
I think the only one left,
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, is the A7.
All right, so we can dispense with A5 and A6, Representative Johnson?
That's correct.
Okay, so Representative Johnson moves the A7 amendment. Representative Johnson.
I move the A7 amendment that deletes $50 million and inserts $80 million for basically the same reason that Representative Simon articulated, so I won't go into depth.
And as with the Simonson Amendment, we don't have a target for this committee yet, but there's nothing wrong with dreaming big. Representative Kreshaw, any comments?
Let's make a deal. I'll take it.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kreshaw, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and I'll be very brief. Obviously, we've demonstrated that at least the need for the conversation. We're willing to up the amount, and I concur with the chair. If we're going to try and dream big, let's do that. Just very quickly, I think there's a balance we need to strike. We know that we had 19.4 awarded and 44 million in requests, and I think it's in our best interest to be financial stewards. And let's pick the right number. If we had picked the number too big last time, we would have money sitting out there that we'd be fighting over. And so at that point, I think there's a demonstrated need for broadband out in greater Minnesota. I think there's a demonstrated need for private partner relationships, and I support that, and I hope you'll support the bill as well.
Thank you. This is Representative Kreshaw, did you have any other invited testifiers? Okay.
I think I'm okay, Mr. Chair, unless anybody wants to come up from the public.
So we do have an amendment that first of all, this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? I also want to make sure before we complete this bill, I'd like to discuss the situation in Annandale, and there's some language that we have that I'd like to present before the committee. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association. I also staff the chair of the Governor's Broadband Task Force, Margaret Anderson Kelleher. Unfortunately, she can't be here with us today. She's testifying across the hall, but I did just want to draw to your attention a letter from her in your packet in support of House File 593, and we are in support of increasing the funding, of course. So with that, I'll answer any questions you might have. Thanks.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Dan Dorman, Executive Director, Greater Minnesota Partnership. First, I'd like to say I hope Speaker Kelleher remiss that she should be here. She should have brought birthday cake for everyone today
because right.
It's her birthday.
29th birthday, that, if I remember right, Representative.
What's that?
I think it's her 29th birthday, if I remember
right. 29th. The Greater Minnesota Partnership is very supportive of what Representative Kreisha is doing in this bill and pushing it forward, supportive of the amendments, dream big, as you said, until targets are set. So we love it all. It's a very important economic development tool, and we think that this is the future of what we need to do for the state and in order to make sure we're competitive with not just our neighboring states but other countries. Anytime that we're getting beaten up by Belarus on something, it's not a good day in Minnesota, in my view. So thank you, Mr. Chair. We're supportive.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll go to members' questions. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, you speak to dreaming big. Great. And seems how no targets are set. I've been following this committee a little bit, and we're now closing in on the $400 million mark, I think. And these are some pretty big numbers. And as a past chair of this committee and member of this committee for the last too many years, last year was the first time we broached $150 million in budgetary targets. So I'm wondering if the chair has any thing he would care to share with the committee about indications where your target's going to go. Because your speaker and you as the chair, I'm sure have had discussions about what the target's going to have to be. And the expectations that everybody brings a bill that adds $50 million or $20 million or $30 million or tax cuts here or tax breaks there, pretty soon you're talking real dollars. So if you got anything that you would be willing to share with the committee?
Well, Representative Mahoney, you asked a couple of questions there. One, you should know that actually I have not spoken with the speaker about what the targets for this committee will be. On the Republican side, we do things a little bit differently. We meet with the individual members and identify their priorities in terms of tax relief, growing the economy, expanding jobs, and what those areas are. So the targets on the Republican side come from the bottom up, not the top down. In terms of what that target's going to be, obviously the economy nationwide is growing. Last year we saw the stock market rise, so we have additional capital gains revenue. But there are some concerns going forward. We have a large amount of our tax revenue coming from a very small sliver of the population. And that the results of that could mean that we're going to have increased volatility in our revenue streams. And so where we're going to come down in terms of where the House targets are, where we're going to the compromises that will be reached with the Senate DFL as well as the minority caucuses of both the House and Senate as well as Governor Dayton, I have no additional guidance to offer to you. I would just say that I think that there's a focus on growing jobs and repurposing existing dollars in a more effective way. The jurisdiction of this committee is substantially bigger than it was 2 years ago. So comparing the committee target of now to the committee target of yesterday, not only is that not comparing apples to apples, it's more like comparing apples to hand grenades. It's a really completely different situation. So Representative Mahoney.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, comparing the committee target this year versus the last biennium, we're pretty close to similar because housing, energy, and commerce were all folded into the jobs bill and that was the basic target. And again, it didn't go much over $175 million, I think. And again, we're almost double that at this particular time. And I think it's disingenuous for members to continually bring big dollar bills in front of this committee and send letters home saying I'm bringing home the bacon, so to speak. You know, that would be appropriate down in Austin, but, you know, poor Mel Gilbert.
Representative Mahoney, I would point out that when the bill came today, the amendments for this bill came from Representative Simonson and Representative Johnson, who I still believe are members of the DFL caucus. And as a courtesy to those members, Representative Crecia accepted those amendments. As I said, we do not have a target. I have no problem with members stating what their priorities are, but obviously it's unrealistic to expect that every member of the legislature is going to have every single tax reduction or spending priority of theirs included in the final completed budget package. The numbers just don't work that way, except for mine. Yeah. Representative Mahoney, we do have 10 bills on the agenda today, and we have people who need to... We need to wrap up before 2:30, so I'm happy to let you have the floor, but understand we have quite a bit
because of
Representative Mahoney.
And I thought it was very nice of all the members of the committee. It was a unanimous vote to put all those dollars onto this particular bill. And I think we're now at $130 million on this particular bill, which is, I think broadband is an appropriate dollar figure. We've had the conversation in committee, and I understand your particular thoughts. So maybe we should start having roll call votes on all these dollar figures so people actually are held accountable to these numbers.
Well, Representative Mahoney, we are laying this bill over for possible inclusion. I think that absent having a target, I see no harm in at least considering these ideas. But again, at some point this committee will have a target. We will be voting on those bills. I expect there will be roll calls then. But right now I see no harm in members of both sides of the aisle identifying their priorities and talking about what their wish lists are. Again, those tax cuts and those spending items, they're going to be far larger than the $1.8 billion surplus we have. But that being said, it's the thoughts of this chair that we should not be squelching ideas or shutting those things down. We want to have an open dialogue. And just not quite as long of an open dialogue right now, Representative Mahoney. But if you want to keep talking, you can, Representative Mahoney.
Are you trying to give me a subtle hint, Mr. Chair?
In serious, Representative Mahoney, we have many testifiers, and I don't want to make – we're going to be coming back tonight at 6:30 either way. We can talk about this then. I think you've made your point, but I don't want to cut you off. So, Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do want to make the final point that, you know, people are bringing forth these large dollar figure bills, and you are going to have to disappoint them. You are going to have to disappoint them. So my concern is for your personal safety. Do you
have Representative Mahoney, I appreciate you looking out for.
Well, you're part Mahoney. Of the pipe trades family, so to speak.
Thank you. Is there anything else, Representative Mahoney?
I think I've made my point.
You have made your point more than once. Thank you, Representative Metza. Do you want to make the point a 15th time now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not the same point. I wanted to actually thank our companies, Representative Crecia, who we hooked up in the interim between sessions here, and Deed for their work on this.
And you and Representative Crecia hooked up in the interim?
On a bill.
Take that for what it was meant.
I'm just
to
repeating
be.
What you said. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
But I really do think that we did prove that this could be a successful program. It reached communities that didn't have broadband. There was a lot of work between our local townships in my district and around the state, really getting the need out there for people who didn't have access to high-speed internet. And I know that was an area of contention in the language last year, so I just wanted to thank all the parties involved for making it successful and, I think, ready for the next round of funding. Thank you.
Members, before you right now is some language labeled A150157, and this is a specific appropriation to the community of Annandale. And there are, regardless of people's concerns or thoughts about the broadband program, there's some issues that I think would be, it's good for the committee to understand. I'm not going to formally move this language, but I do have a testifier here who I'd like to talk about this and talk about the concerns and what it means for the specific community and perhaps have a small discussion on. So welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marty Seifert. I represent the city of Annandale in this issue on broadband. I want to thank you and Representative Crecia for entertaining the idea of this. Representative McDonald will actually be introducing a bill, so this will not be formally introduced. We're not going to ask Representative Crecia to have this attached to his bill. But we do have two items in your packet. One is just some of the challenges Annandale has had as a community relating to, they did apply for the broadband program, they were denied. I think probably the best explanation is on the back of this, which is the Dairy Queen in Annandale saying, welcome, we are unable to accept your credit cards due to internet connection. Sorry for the inconvenience. We have a lot of businesses in Annandale, Minnesota that are suffering from problems with internet connectivity. They are not a deep rural community, but they are outside the Seven County Metro. They plan to try to get another application in, but they're also working on legislation, and Representative McDonald's bill will be in the next couple days. So we just wanted to, we're kind of caught in the cross time frame of this, Mr. Chair. So we just wanted to draw members' attention to that. There is an article from the St. Cloud Times that talks about a business that left town, and in speaking with the owners, that the chief reason was their internet connections were so bad they lost a spice company to another community. So we just want members to know about that. There will be legislation coming in a formal bill form. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Seifert. Representative Krishoff.
Thank you. And just thank you, members and Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Seifert, for your testimony. Just quick comments. I think what you said, members, we do bring concerns from our districts back up, and we ask for those conversations. To Representative Mahoney, sometimes that does result in disappointment, but it doesn't mean that we don't care. And in the case of the Annandale, I've reached out to Representative McDonald. I've reached out to Mr. Dorman and Mr. Seifert, and I'll reach out to Annandale as well. We're going to see if we can find a solution that may be outside of just trying to make this a political situation where we're trying to force dollars. And I think there's a way we can do that. I think we need to have a conversation. We need to make sure that this competitive process is pure and working the best it can. So thank you very much for indulging me, and thank you for allowing me to have my bill in front of your committee and for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative Krisha. Representative Mahoney.
Well, Representative Krisha, you know, I guess 11 years ago, my daughter, who was 17 at the time, desperately wanted to go to New York to buy her prom dress. And I had to explain to her that I was more than happy to take her to Nordstrom's, but I wasn't popping for an airline ticket. You have to live in reality. So, again, members, $130 million here, $130 million there. Pretty soon we got a couple bucks. And I don't know when the bottom up comes, but I'd sure like to find out when the bottom up is done and we can start having real conversations, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point will be short here. I think that with this Annandale project, hopefully if we add some more funding to the broadband package, that would be sufficient to take care of it. I think that, you know, we shouldn't be picking winners and losers in the committee here. I'd imagine that could get pretty contentious, because I've got a lot of my communities who would love to have higher speed internet courtesy of the state.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to point out to Representative Mahoney and all the rest of the committees that last year under your chairmanship we had for the Commerce, Housing, Deed, Dolly, and the rest of the boards, we spent $438,959. So we aren't too far over there, and I'm sure when we get our targets, we'll be able to accommodate our targets with a little bit of effort. It's not going to be fun, but we'll do it.
Any other additional comments from members of the committee? With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 593 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, the Department of Demography. And first of all, thank you very much for making yourself available today. Representative Wagenius had actually requested some you guys to be available to the committee. I thought it was a good idea, but of course, the day we schedule you, she is not able to. She's excused. She has a commitment that doesn't allow her to be here. So, and I'm thinking for your presentation, we'll probably go about 20 minutes. Is that okay? Does that work out? Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Susan Brower. I'm Minnesota State Demographer, and I work in the Department of Administration. I've been asked to speak to you today about the demographic trends that impact Minnesota's workforce. I'll show you how things look right now and which factors will determine if we stay on the track that we're on right now, for better or for worse. And if there's time, I'll conclude with some of the changes that will be impacting the demand for housing going forward. So the big change, of course, is the retirement of the baby boomers. This is the big underlying trend that will alter the employment and the jobs growth picture for the into the foreseeable future. The baby boomers, who are now ages 51 to 69, have begun to move into retirement ages. On this graph, we can start to see the growth of Minnesotans age 65 plus accelerate around 2010 and continue to grow rapidly to 2030 as the baby boomers reach 65. If we were to experience aging as a state at the pace that we've always experienced it since 1950, we'd stay on that yellow dotted line there, but that's not how things are going to play out. The older adult population, the baby boomers moving into retirement, has begun to accelerate. We're about 5 years into a 20-year transition, and that will continue over the next 15 years. So what does that mean for future economic growth and future job growth? Because the engine of our state's economy, Minnesota's labor force, is going to experience slower growth as the baby boomers retire, we'll likely to see a dampened impact on overall economic growth. So what we're seeing here are projections for labor force growth going forward. That yellow bar is showing you where we are now. And right now we're growing at about 0.5% each year during that time period. And if you compare it to what we've experienced, say, in the 90s and the 2000s, it's considerably lower. And looking forward, we'll continue to our labor force will continue to slow. So this is happening while the baby boomers are moving out into retirement, and a smaller cohort age group is moving in to take their place. Another way to look at this, another way to kind of get your head around this change, is to look at this in numeric terms. In the 2000s, Minnesota added about 25,000 additional workers each year during that decade to our labor force. Between 2010 and 2020, that number will be much closer to 8,000. And between 2020 and 2030, we'll add just 4,000 additional workers annually. So considerably slower growth ahead. This is the natural outcome of this massive kind of...
Ms. Brower, just a quick question. With regards to those numbers, does that include migration patterns away from Minnesota and to Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, it does. When we make our labor force projections, we look at our population projections, which include births, deaths, and migration in and out. And then we take into account labor force participation rates and what we think they'll do in the future.
Okay, thank you.
So one possible outcome of this transition is a dampening of job growth because there are not enough workers to fill the positions that employers need to meet the demands of their businesses. When we compare the pace of growth that Deed has projected for job growth alongside the pace of growth that we project for labor force growth, you can see jobs there are in blue, workers are in red, our projections. We see that the pace of growth for jobs is much steeper than the pace of growth for workers. This graph is certainly an oversimplified picture of what's likely to play out in the years ahead, but I show it to you because I just want to show you that we're at a critical juncture here where jobs are on one trajectory, our labor force, available workers, are on another, and there's likely to be some interplay between the availability of workers and the availability of employers to fill jobs and to continue to be able to create jobs. So we've looked at what the aging trend is likely to look like in terms of projected, how it will impact projected labor force growth. I want to look briefly at some of the factors that will impact future growth, including migration. one of the ways that the state can counter aging is through migration, not only attracting and welcoming new people to the state, but also retaining the people that we already have here. Migration and labor force growth tend to go hand in hand, and we're looking here at a scatter plot of 50 states. The graph shows you that states that have more migration also have faster growing labor forces. As you move from left to right on this graph, you will see the states with slower growing labor forces on the left and very quickly growing labor forces on the right. That's North Dakota and Washington, D.C. on the far right.
So, Ms. Brower, is this a chicken versus egg thing? do people go where the jobs are or the vice versa?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Good answer.
Indeed. What's happening here is an iterative process, certainly, that people are moving to where there are job opportunities, but it's also true that where labor force isn't growing, it's difficult to grow jobs there as well. So I believe it's going in both directions. This scatter plot is just to show you that these things tend to go hand in hand, that migration bolsters labor force growth. So just to give you a sense of what migration to and from Minnesota has looked like, in our recent history, we're looking here at migration to the state, net migration in and out of the state since 1991. The gold bars are showing you domestic net migration, so people moving to and from other states in the U.S. And the blue bars are showing international net, so they're showing people moving to and from Minnesota from other countries.
Ms. Brower, the previous graph that you have, they showed, this is really interesting. Is there any way to get, could you provide the committee with a graph that shows those numbers from, say, 2000 to 2013 to have a 10-year sample included with that, additional sample? Is that a possible capability?
That's possible, yes. I will do that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and we have I don't want to interrupt you a lot, just a little bit. So we do have a question from a member of the committee. We'll get this question, and then we'll come back to you and let you wrap up. So Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to note that it looks like people started leaving once Governor Pawlenty was elected.
Oh. It's 2010, Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, the next graph, the domestic net migration. Our international went up, our domestic went down. If I'm understanding that right, that's people from the state leaving and the international migration going up?
Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, around 2002, we started having negative net migration. That means that we lost more people to other states than we gained. I don't think that there is a clear, straightforward explanation for why that far flipped around. However, certainly it has something to do with our economy relative to other states' economy, the availability of jobs.
I suspect it wasn't Representative or Governor Pawlenty's arrival, more was like Governor Ventura's departure. That's probably what it had to do with it. Please continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, so what I want you to see here is that we've had quite a bit of a turnaround since 2002 in terms of our domestic migration situation, very different compared to what we've seen in the 1990s. We still attract more people to the state than we lose moving away when we account for international immigration, which is that blue bar there. And we're not alone in terms of losing more residents to other states. In fact, it tends to be a pattern for the Midwestern states and for the Eastern states to have net losses to other states in the country. And those states that are gainers tend to be those in the South and in the Southwest in particular.
Ms. Brower, is Louisiana and Mississippi on the map here? I mean, they're kind of our geographic outliers there. Is that a result of, hangover, the demographic hangover from Katrina, or is there other factors that play into that? Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak specifically to why their migration. I'm not familiar with their specific situation in Louisiana, Mississippi.
But obviously you can see a general migration of from cold weather climates to warm weather climates, with the exception of California.
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
So there's climate, and our location on the map is certainly a big factor that influences our domestic migration patterns. If we look at net migration from abroad, international migration, all states are positive. Some have more international net migration than others, but that seems to be a consistent pattern across the U.S. So who are the people who move to Minnesota, and maybe more importantly for the discussion today, who are the people who leave Minnesota? People coming from other states and leaving to other states is largely people who are moving to a neighboring state, to Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa. These consistently top the list of where people are leaving to and where they're coming from. We also send a fairly large proportion to Arizona, to Texas, when we look at what states are our top. Iowa.
Watch it.
Ms. Brower.
Mr. Chair, though, in all seriousness,
Representative Hortman.
Iowa has had a very specific effort to attract people to the state that they've been working on for about the last 6 years, in particular young people.
Yep. Representative Metza.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say that one Iowan's moving to northern, or has moved to northern Minnesota to marry this poor fellow here, so we're getting one there.
Representative Scott, any Iowa demographic
too.
Issues? All right. Ms. Brower, back on task.
Mr. Chair. When we look more closely at the characteristics of the people who move across state lines, it becomes very obvious that there is a very strong pattern, age pattern, to those losses and to the movement in general. Young people ages 18, 19, 20 are much more likely to move across state lines. And these are the age groups that we are most likely to experience net losses as well. The ages where we see the greatest migration is also where we're losing the most people, ages 18, 19, 20, when people tend to be moving to school. And indeed, if we look at whether or not those migrants, people moving away from Minnesota, are then enrolled in school as they're captured by the census data, we can see that a large proportion of those, the proportion in blue there, are moving to go to college or to graduate school. So I began this presentation by discussing the role of aging baby boomers in contributing to slower labor force growth. That same aging trend will impact the growth of the state's population more generally, as we have a larger share of our state in the older age groups. The number of deaths will rise, and it will become more difficult to grow just from births. We've kind of come to rely on this internal momentum that is built into our age structure, but as we age, as we become an older state, our growth will become slower and slower from that internal momentum. And we'll need to rely increasingly on in-migration and on migration to meet the demands of our employers and our growing labor force. Because we've begun this transition to an older society, we're moving into this era of slower labor force growth. We need to maximize the contribution of every potential worker in the state. So there are a number of groups that historically have been underutilized in our labor force. Some notable examples include older workers, people with disabilities, parents, people of color, and people with lower levels of education or skills that don't align well. And these groups are another opportunity that we can think about as we move forward into this era of slower labor force growth. So how do we incorporate better every potential worker that we have living here in the state? I'll focus specifically, though, on older workers and people of color. Because oftentimes I hear when I'm giving talks that people think, well, older workers are going to kind of solve this issue for us because they're going to work far past the typical retirement age. We haven't seen a shift that would suggest that that is going to be the trend that saves us from the slower labor force growth. There has been some change since the recession in older adults working longer, but it still very much keeps to the pattern where after about age 60 or so, we start seeing pretty significant drop-offs in labor force participation. Populations of color are among the groups that have also been historically underutilized in the state, and these populations are growing quickly. Here's a graph showing just what the growth of populations of color has looked like in the state of Minnesota. You can see in 1960 there were very few people of color, and the Asian Minnesotan population, Black or African American, and the Hispanic or Latino populations in particular have grown very rapidly over the last 20 or so years. And these are the groups that we anticipate will continue to grow when we project the growth into the future. And so as we become a more diverse state and as our labor force growth slows, it will become increasingly important to close some of the persistent gaps in labor force participation that we see here, particularly people of color who were born right here in Minnesota and are facing some of the poorest outcomes. Here we see rates of labor force participation, which include people who are employed and people who are looking for work. And we can see that the rates are highest for U.S.-born whites, and some of our lowest labor force participation rates are for U.S.-born blacks or African Americans and American Indians. The same differences emerge when we look at unemployment rates. Similar differences, I should say.
Ms. Brower, if we could just go back to the previous slide, I have a question. With each of these items, we see that the foreign-born workforce participation rate is higher, with the exception of whites. But when we go to the all area, foreign-born participation is lower. How do you account for that?
Mr. Chair, that would be because the white population still makes up the vast majority of the state. Right now in the state, about 17% of the state are people of color, about 15% of the labor force, and so that's still driving the overall difference is the white non-Hispanic group that we see first.
But it's only 2 percentage points for whites, and it's 5% for overall. You don't have to answer. If you just get back to me on that and let me know, maybe show the raw numbers, that would be helpful. It's interesting that foreign-born ethnic minorities have a higher workforce participation rate than U.S.-born. So, please continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one way to think about how the state's racial composition will change in the future is to look at the racial diversity by age. Here we see that the youngest Minnesotans in the state are also the most diverse. And as the baby boomers, who are largely white non-Hispanic, move out of the working years, which are typically 16 to 64, they're replaced by a much more diverse younger generation moving into their working years. So I've showed you a lot of numbers here. We've seen how Minnesota will age and what the likely impact of growth of the labor force will be. I've presented the most recent data on migration, where Minnesota stands with respect to that. I think for the sake of time, I'll wrap it up there, Mr. Chair. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Thank you very much. Questions from members of the committee. Representative Swazinski, then Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just moving back in your presentation to the page 7, the top slide there, just kind of from an in-and-out standpoint, just especially from that the 84, 85, I know some of the services are involved with some of that return. But have we ever looked at from that net losses to gain? Is other than other reasons, were a lot of those folks potentially from Minnesota at one point in time, and then they move back in a later age, or is it just following their kids? Do we track any of that type of reason for at all? So, thank you,
Mr. Chair, Representative. Our primary source of migration data that allows us to look at characteristics of people is census data, which doesn't follow people over time. We can get some sense of who the people are who are returning by looking at their birthplace, and indeed Native Minnesotans or people who are married to Native Minnesotans tend to be a huge source of our return migration to the state. typically migration by people who have no other familial connection or historical connection tends to be related either to economics or, in the case of refugees, to come to a safe place.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a quick question on page 3 of our handout. We have the projected job growth and projected labor force growth. Would you clarify for me, Ms. Brower, when you talk about jobs, are you talking about all jobs, or are you talking about full-time employment? When you, is a job? Is it a part-time job? Are they full-time jobs? How? When you say jobs, what are you? What do you mean,
Ms. Brower?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would include. You know, I'm going to have to check with LEAD on that, on their projections, to see how they define employment in their projections. I can get that to you.
Sound good? Any other questions from members of the committee? Ms. Brower, would you be open to maybe coming back to the committee at some point in the future, or do you detest appearing before this lecture?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
I just think there's a tremendous amount of information that's available for policymakers to understand, and I think if there's one thing members should take away from this is that workforce is an increasingly relevant and important issue for the state of Minnesota's competitiveness going forward, and we cannot afford to have anybody sitting on the bench, whether they're in prison, whether they're idle at home, whether they're in a job that's below their skill set, or if we have an education system that's not providing them with the advanced skill set we need in the 21st century. We just cannot afford to have people on the bench, and that's something that we all have to do a better job working on going forward. So thank you very much, and I hope you don't mind if we invite you back again.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Is Representative Hackbarth here? Oh, there he is. Representative Hackbarth. The chair will move House File 1262 for possible inclusion in a later bill. And members, for the remaining committee, this is what I have on our agenda. We have Representative Hackbarth, then Representative Keel, and then Representative Dabney, those three bills. I think the other bills are probably going to be, definitely will be waiting until the evening session. If things go exceptionally fast, then I suppose there's a possibility we could get to Representative Smith's bill, but I'm suspecting those are the three bills we'll be looking at. So, again, the chair moves House File 1262 for possible inclusion. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're going to be very brief and direct in presenting our bill. Mr. Chairman, if you could move the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that we'd like, I'd appreciate it.
Now, the chair will move the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would like. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We will be brief and direct in our proposal here. My witnesses have been directed to do so. And, Mr. Chairman, this is a bill that adversely affects there was a bill in Congress that adversely affects some businesses in the upper Mississippi, north of the upper St. Anthony Falls, where the dam is going to, lock and dam is going to be closed, and Congress included in that legislation, they recommend that the state and local governments mitigate potential economic impacts to this action that they took, and that's why we're here today, and these folks can tell the story much better than I. So at this time, we'd take testimony from these folks.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Steve Ettinger from Northern Meadow Recycling. Per WERDA and the mandated closing of the St. Anthony Lock and Dam, we're seeking partial compensation for the requirement to transfer all of our, we have a company that operates 15 locations in 3 states. It was all built on the premise of shipping waterborne by barge from Minneapolis. Because of the closure of the lock, we're going to be forced to ship everything by truck starting June 10th when the St. Anthony lock closes. So for every barge that we load, which is 2 barges a day, it's 1,400 tons a day, we're going to transfer that into trucks, which is about 70 truckloads per barge, so about 140 truckloads per day. So we're seeking partial compensation to help us with the additional cost of transportation and the possible relocation of part of our main infrastructure and processing equipment outstate.
And Mr. Ettinger, how is this not a government taking of private property when they did this? I mean, by closing this, they are eliminating the one way you can transport via a waterway.
Right.
How does that not qualify as a government taking of private property?
I don't know that I'm quite qualified to answer that question, but maybe Jack is.
Maybe from your perspective, you could just say it is a taking of private property.
we invested a few $100 million to have 15 operations focus and transfer all of the operation of metal recycling to that one location for the sole purpose of shipping by barge. Now that's being taken away from us 5 years after we built that plant out.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record, or whoever's testifying next. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, I'm Bob Burogle with Aggregate Industries. Our story is pretty much similar to Steve's story. Ours goes back a few more years. A little bit of history, I suppose, might be useful here. Aggregate Industries used to be the Sheely Company, the J.L. Sheely Company. And so that company goes back to the 1914s or thereabouts. And commencing in about the mid-50s, Joe Sheely commissioned what he called the Irish Navy to haul sand and gravel up from the upper and lower St. Anthony, upper and lower Great Cloud Island mines into the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so for 60 years or so, Sheely and now Aggregate Industries has been hauling barge materials, sand and gravel barge materials, up into these central cities. Over those 60 years, something in the neighborhood of 40 million tons of construction aggregate have come into the downtowns of Minneapolis and St. Paul. Virtually, or let's say almost every major bridge, road, and building in the downtowns has been constructed with material from those two island mines. That would be examples of those would be the I-35 bridge, the X in St. Paul, the Target Center, the twin stadium, the Gopher Stadium, and now the Viking Stadium. Last year, we hauled from those two island mines approximately 2 million tons into the downtown metro, downtown markets. And of those 2 million tons, approximately 400,000 tons went from the island mines up into the Minneapolis site, which is above the upper and lower upper St. Anthony lock. So the impact to our business with the closure of the lock, which will happen on June 10th, is an impact of our ability then to carry that kind of material, 400,000 tons a year, to that site, which is a significant impact in transportation costs, but also we anticipate a loss, an actual loss of business as a result of that. So going forward, our ability to provide low cost and lower cost materials for all these construction projects that are happening in the downtowns, it will be limited. And our ability then to service our customers will also be limited. And so the result of that closure is a significant economic impact to the company and the customers that we serve.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Jack Perry from the Briggs & Morgan Law Firm, and I represent both these gentlemen and their companies. And I'm not going to repeat what they had to say, but I am going to comment to Representative Metza. I married an Iowa woman 29 years ago. It worked out well. There was a comment earlier about winners and losers with regard to a city and some funding. And in this case, we have a very clear winner. We have a winner in that the public was able to create some protections and some additional barriers to Asian carp. It was a bipartisan effort in D.C. to make this happen. There was also a bipartisan recognition in the comments to that bill that while this is a taking, it's not a compensable taking, and that federal government doesn't have to do that. It's a federal navigable waterway, so they don't have to pay, but it meets every other definition of a taking, which is why you made your comment, Mr. Chair. But the losers, in this case, we have a very clear identified losers are sitting right here, right next to you. And
I don't think he quite meant it the way it came out.
Well, but
if that is the case, you can always find new litigators to represent you. But it's go ahead, sir.
So the question is you know, the when we first started talking to legislators, the first comment was, well, this is congressional action; they should do that. Well, we've obviously explored that. that's gotten us nowhere, and we don't expect that to change, though we'll keep pushing. So the question is, well, what can you guys do? And what we have tried to do with Representative Hackbarth in this bill is to be realistic. There was a comment made, or, you know, let's not be in dream world. At the time we put this bill together, we had no idea there would be the surplus there is. So this was premised not on a full recovery. There is no way that the state of Minnesota would be able to compensate these people for the loss that they are going to incur. I mean, when you take away the river from river-oriented businesses, you are creating a complete nightmare. We're not expecting full recovery. This is nowhere near a full recovery. If you want to see our books and see what the full recovery would be, we can certainly show that to you. What we tried to do is come up with a number that was realistic for us to adjust to the new world order without a river. And in the case in particular with Steve and his company, one of the things that we've been working, and we met yesterday with the city of Minneapolis, is to find out a number that would incentivize Mr. Ettinger's company to move the shredder, which has been a source of huge, it's conderator is the term most people know it as. But that's a number that would incentivize Mr. Ettinger to move that part of the operation, and maybe more, outside of the metropolitan area, and change it from a river-oriented business to that portion to a train. And of course, to do that is way more than $20 million, but it's something that Mr. Ettinger has promised to the legislators he's met with individually, would promise to this committee to do. But he only has authorization from his British headquarters. That's he needs that money in order to actually relocate. But and Bob's company as well is looking to find places to relocate the barge portion of the business. The first efforts to do so didn't work out so well. We tried to find some location by University of Minnesota, but of course, anywhere you're going to move a barge operation is going to create some local issues. But both companies are committed to trying to use this money to have a long-term reduction in what this impact will be, because these companies are vital to particularly Bob's company, to Minneapolis and every single project that goes on in the city of Minneapolis. So these are not dream numbers. This is real numbers, and the number that these guys need to compensate for this loss.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Did you have any other invited testimony? Okay. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Go ahead, sir.
I do have a handout, though, that I didn't make my copies.
If you could work with the committee administrator, and we'll get it cleared. Go ahead, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm just for clarification, I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill.
If you could just state your name for the record.
Sure. Tom Diamond, St. Paul, Minnesota. First of all, I'd like to comment that I served as a city council member in St. Paul, and we have spent at St. Paul millions of dollars to revitalize the riverfront and create jobs and opportunities in the city of St. Paul. Specifically, we spent millions of dollars to remove scrap metal yards from the riverfront because we found that we can create more jobs, opportunities for housing and development with this prime riverfront property. It is ironic, to say the least, to have a bill coming here to suggest that the state is going to spend millions, tens of millions of dollars to force scrap metal yards back onto the riverfront in St. Paul, or expand existing ones. We, as I say, have spurred significant redevelopment and jobs and housing in the riverfront with the revitalization with higher use on the riverfront. The scrap yard, metal yard in Minneapolis has been a highly controversial, to say the least. There have been lawsuits with the city. There has been real problems with the community about pollution, noise from the facility, the shredder, the conderator. There's been legislation here at the Capitol that dealing with this. It has been a real problem and has had a real impact on the community. We do not need to have that sort of a problem brought to the city of St. Paul into our riverfront. And the locations of where they're talking about this development are areas that are immediately adjacent to a parkland and in close proximity to residential neighborhoods. It is also troubling that this is a $40 million proposed taxpayer subsidy. When, I don't know about you, but I've been watching the news recently. There's been ads about sending $350 back to every taxpayer and homeowner in St. Paul, in Minnesota, and returning the dollars. And here, we're talking about, instead of sending that money back to the individuals, the residents of the state, sending $20 million apiece to two large global corporations that are headquartered outside of the state. If this committee, in its wisdom, has $40 million additional to send to the city of St. Paul for economic development, I would encourage you very much to do that. But send it to the city of St. Paul, send it to the city council or the St. Paul Housing and Redevelopment Authority in a clean bill that allows the city to target it to the small and medium-sized businesses that actually create the most jobs and create the most economic opportunities in the city. I would caution to, that this concept that there has been harm done to these businesses is an interesting concept, to say the least, because what you're talking about here is that these businesses have compete with other businesses. There are other scrap dealers in the state. There are other aggregate dealers in the state. Those dealers also ship in and out of the metropolitan area. Not all of these competitors have use of the river. So other businesses, private businesses, in business, do not get, have not gotten this, what is a, amounts to over a $3 million subsidy. That's the cost, that's the federal cost of operating this lock and dam system, this part of it. They get a $3 million, these businesses have been enjoying a $3 million subsidy that their competitors have not been receiving all these years. Those competitors have been able to compete in the free marketplace with these at that disadvantage. When you remove that federal taxpayer subsidy from one side of the equations, from some of the competitors, so they're now on a level playing field, you ship by other means, there is some idea that you have to compensate them because they are no longer getting a subsidized, taxpayer-subsidized edge against their competitors. That is actually dumbfounding to me. Maybe it makes sense to this committee, but it is, from somebody who's a private businessman, that is an astounding argument to be made. Also, none of that argument has been placed in a record as to what those costs are. And if you take a look at the legislation that's drafted, it does not require that they actually demonstrate a loss and that there's a tie to that loss, nor is there a tie to that they actually spend it on things that relate to that loss. So with that in mind, I would strongly encourage you not to pass this as drafted. If you do have the money, allocate the money for redevelopment in St. Paul, where we can really make a difference in our neighborhoods and our communities to really create jobs and really make a difference, and not arbitrarily impose the will of the legislature on what development should be in St. Paul by tying this to specific projects, which, might I add, and I think is a very important point, have never been discussed in our community. I live in the area where these proposals would be going, and there has been no discussion of this at all. On the other hand, we have plans like the Great River Passage Plan, economic development plans for the neighborhoods that have had thorough review and consideration and balancing of needs and opportunities for the community that are begging for resources from this legislature and other places, and they are not getting the resources they need. I would encourage you strongly to fund the programs that have actually been discussed, actually been reviewed, and are have support in the community, than to tie up valuable money in programs that have a very high probability of not being able to be implemented. Because if you think there's legislation and concerns in Minneapolis about a shredding of materials, including asbestos, and letting those get airborne in a community, I will tell you that there are similar concerns in St. Paul, and there will be great debate, if questionable, as to whether there can be approval. So I think it's a unwise a way to allocate resources. It's certainly a very poor way to use public resources. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll take any questions if there are any.
Thank you, sir. And are you testifying on behalf of the St. Paul Port Authority?
I am not. I'm speaking on behalf of an individual who lives in St. Paul.
Okay. So thank you. Are there any other members of the public which testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. And I would just, if you've heard your previous points mentioned earlier, they've been noted, if you could maybe expedite your testimony. We do have questions from members. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, my name is Lori Lauder, Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. Just a few quick comments, if I might. I'm not here to speak in favor or against the bill, but just to note a couple of things. First of all, Mr. Chair, we only discovered that our name was on this bill within the past 24 hours, so we haven't spent a lot of time reviewing it. Having said that, though, we see that it provides for the Port Authority essentially to serve as a fiscal agent, and we are comfortable doing that. We like to help wherever we can, so we would be happy to serve that role. Mr. Chair, also, we're willing to coordinate with other parties as perhaps some clarifications could be made in this bill. For example, we're not assuming that the relocation of these companies would go to the St. Paul Harbor. In fact, as to one of the numbers, I think it's number 5 on page 2 of the bill, if you read that, I think we take that to mean perhaps that it's referring to rail and truck when it talks about alternative methods. So we do think there could be some perhaps useful clarifications made, and we'd be happy to work with Representative Hackbarth and others to perhaps make those clarifications. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this hearing and we'll move on to member questions. Representative Swazinski, Johnson, Metza, and Hortman. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a general question. You know, because of the unique nature of this, you know, in farmland, what gets purchased from, you know, the metro area and sold in the metro area, that they have an exchange program. It'd be interesting to see from a property standpoint, rather, you know, from a grant, but maybe from a tax base where they could transfer the property, because obviously there's worth there when they leave their site. And if they could take some taxable advantages and move that. I don't know if the state has any programs like that, but just looking at other solutions. So just more of a comment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, I guess, for North Metals and Aggregate Industries. And the question, pretty simple, has come up, is where do you plan to relocate?
To either the testifiers or both of them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we initially were looking in the University of Minnesota area at the area of the old coal docks. That doesn't look like a particularly likely site at this point. We don't have another site in mind at the moment.
And to the other testifier?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, in response to what was already said, we operate a long-term lease with the Port Authority in St. Paul that's in existence for the next several decades now. I believe it's a very long-term lease. We stevedore salt, we stevedore petroleum coke, we load a certain amount of scrap. Under no circumstances would we relocate a shredder or any processing. We're not permitted to process at that facility, so that's not an issue whatsoever. It'll never happen. That's not part of our plan. For relocation, we would look to relocate outside of the metropolitan area where most of our operations are northwest on the 94 corridor. So no operations would go from Minneapolis to St. Paul. We already operate a metal recycling facility on Barge Channel Road in St. Paul. We have no need for that, nor would we do it.
Representative Johnson, did you have any follow-up?
Yes. I do have a follow-up. I just want to confirm then that you're saying that you're not going to relocate in St. Paul, is that what you just said?
Zero chance of that.
Okay.
Representative Johnson.
Very good. That's, you know, that's good. Good to hear. And the other guy, your Aggregate Industries.
Yes.
And you don't know where you're going to locate.
The testifier.
Is that correct? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's correct, sir.
But, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Johnson.
Do you own property on Childs Road?
We have a lease with the Port Authority on Childs Road, Representative.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that in consideration then as an option for you to relocate there?
To testify.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that site, we will continue to use that site as we have for the last 60 years. We don't anticipate changing the use of that facility except for perhaps additional trucking that will result, that will be generated from that site.
Representative Johnson.
Okay, well, just a couple comments, and I'll be brief. One is that we do have a plan for the river down there called the Great River Passage Plan. I think a previous testifier noted that. So anything that changed down in that neck of the woods would need to be consistent with that plan that we've worked on for years and years. So that's kind of like point number one. Secondly, St. Paul is now going to be the navigable head of the Mississippi River from New Orleans to St. Paul, and I really don't think the Port Authority has had the time yet to put together what their vision is of how that whole area is going to look. So before there's any major changes to that site, and I'm not hearing that they're planning on it necessarily, but before anything like that occurred, I think we'd need to see something from the Port Authority with significant community input as to what the vision and plan is for that neck of the woods. And lastly, that's a highly industrial area down there that I'm referring to, down by Childs Road and Warner Road, that is a big concern to the neighborhood. And the whole idea of the plan is to move industry away from the river and make it more accessible and open the Mississippi River to the public. While we certainly see the importance of business and barge traffic, and that's always going to be part of the balance, moving towards consolidated industrialization long term, more of that would be in opposition to the plan for the river around that area. So I just wanted to make those points, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza, then Hortman, then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a few points to make. There's, you know, consequences to certain laws we passed, and this is something where I think we've got some businesses who have been in a while. You know, I don't know enough about the subject matter or the history, but talking to my colleagues here at the table, we do need to provide some kind of assistance when we pass something that drastically affects very specific businesses. And, you know, my area of the state understands that very well, and you'll have my support moving forward. And I just, you know, I have to comment on what the former counselor had said. And what I'm hearing is you're against recycling, you don't want shredding, but you don't want mining either. So you can't have it both ways.
Representative Hortman, then Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to compliment Representative Hackbarth on the bill. I'm very sympathetic. I, for years, have been saying there's no way that they'll close that lock and dam because they can't afford to buy the businesses north of the dam. I used to be a part of a business called John's Auto Parts where we recycled 3,000 cars a year. And you're a critical element in recycling all that metal. And there's a substantial environmental and economic benefit from moving that metal by water and not by truck. So I think I'm very sympathetic, but I think the feds screwed up here. I think it's astonishing that they closed it. And I hope that you'll continue to work with Congressman Ellison and others to try to get compensation from the federal government because, in my opinion, they're the ones that screwed up.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, you're going to be mad at me, but I'm going to take some time here. And my question to the testifier.
Mahoney, I never get mad at you. Representative Mahoney.
You've never seen me angry?
Never, not once.
why isn't this going to the feds? I mean, this is what the feds did so that people on the river wouldn't have to see barges going up and down the river. Oh, wait, I guess it was invasive species. Wait a minute. Oh, I'm sorry, I got that. So why didn't you go to the Fed?
To the testifiers.
We did.
And what was the...
Representative Mahoney.
What was the response of the Fed?
The testifier.
Very little response as to compensation. A lot of empathy for the situation. There's no... The committee notes reflect that everyone recognizes this is effectively a taking. There's no question about that. The only thing I could generalize, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting anybody, but is this is really a a local impact, a state impact, the protection of the state and the tourist industry up north from Asian carp, so the state should pay for it.
Representative Mahoney?
Well, Mr. Chair, did you point out to the fact that the Coon Rapids Dam was just, what did we invest, like $15 or $20
million? $16.5 million, and it's a 99.5% effective barrier. It was not necessary to close the lock and dam to stop the Asian carp.
Okay, so...
Yes, to answer your question, Mr. Chair,
yep.
The answer is yes. We did point that out, but not very effectively, evidently.
Representative Mahoney.
So, to the Northern Metals and to the author of the bill, I know that this is a huge issue, not in my district, but right next to my district, and to the members that, to the constituents that live there. Would you be interested in putting language in that prohibited anything more than a 5% increase in, you know, or whatever, come up with some idea of what your these businesses would see their increase on a typical basis if there had been no change? They could not increase the business being done at these two ports down at the on Childs Road. Because essentially what I'm trying to get to is that I don't want to have to go to a district meeting with 250 rabid Highland Hills people screaming at me. I want you to take care of it, Representative Hatfield. Would you be interested in putting some kind of an amendment on to this bill like that?
Representative Hackworth.
No.
Okay. So,
Representative Mahoney, one last question before we go.
So, Representative Hackbart, to the testifiers, you both kind of indicated that there could easily be an increase in truck traffic. So does this bill take care of any of that cost of 140 trucks possible a year to go down to that to those loading positions at the docks?
To any of the testifiers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's just from Northern Metals. Transferring from barge to truck is it's going to be between 1,000 and 1,500 trucks per month, not per year, just from Northern Metals. Aggregate ships material up, we ship down. So our material would go from Minneapolis down the 94 corridor to our St. Paul operation where it'd be loaded. Our footprint in St. Paul at the St. Paul terminal wouldn't change in any way. If we relocated a shredder, it would be outstate. It wouldn't be in St. Paul. We would continue to utilize our St. Paul port as the only feasible port where we could put material waterborne and load into barges for shipment downriver. But you're talking about 1,000 to 2,000 trucks additional per month from Northern Metals only, not per year.
Representative Mahoney, does that do it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, and from aggregate industries, we anticipate something in the neighborhood of 20,000 trucks a year in addition to what is currently plying the roads.
So, Mr. Chair, Mahoney, that could approximate 4,000 more trucks a month. That's quite the number. So there's a lot more to this bill that has to be worked out. I mean, this is a huge transportation issue, a huge constituent issue, maybe some environmental issues, hard to say, but I don't want to have to breathe that dust. You live not far from there. So this has got a long ways to go. I'm not sure where it's got to go from here. Is it going to be held over, Mr. Chair?
That's correct.
We'll have more conversations.
Representative Fabian.
I'll pass, thank you.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Representative Hackworth?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members and Representative Mahoney. This bill solves some of those problems. It's going to relocate the shredder. It's going to take it out of this area. It's going to put it north of the Twin Cities as a possible relocation for the shredder. It takes those trucks and moves them away from the city, and that's part of the reason we want to do this, part of the reason for this bill. It relocates these things, so we're not going to have some of those problems. That's exactly why this bill is here. These issues were pointed out to a number of different people as the congressional legislation was moving forward. They apparently didn't want to take that into consideration. It didn't happen. We tried to point out that all these trucks were going to be put up on the road at that time. We pointed out a number of different issues. We tried to tell them that they should not close the lock. But all of that's water over the dam. It's gone. I mean, it's done. And this is what we have to deal with now. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today and hear our bill.
Thank you, Representative Hackford. Did you have a closing comment, sir, or not?
Just a clarification to Representative Mahoney's concerns about communications with regulators and are we doing things the right way. We have been in regular communication for Steve. If he's to relocate his shredder, that's a major deal that would involve the Pollution Control Agency. We've been in regular communication with them. We do regular daily business with the port authorities, so we'll be communicating with them. So there will be no surprises as to any changes in operations.
And what date is the, when does it close?
June 10th of this year.
Brutal. All right. Thank you to the testifiers. We appreciate it. Thank you, Representative Hackforth. Representative Keel. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fate, Representative Neuberger.
I had a quick question. Never mind.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel, first of all, I'm going to move House File 751 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll make this really quick. I believe we have 5 minutes or less. This is a job training tax credit for businesses, and I would really like my testifier to explain her view on this. So,
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Libby. I'm a board member.
Ms. Libby, hold on 1 second here. Guests, if you could please take your conversations out to the hallway. Guests, if you could please take your conversations out to the hallway.
Now you're learning the power of a chair. I thank you.
Thank you. Please continue with your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Libby. I'm a board member of the Greater Minnesota Partnership, and I'm president and CEO of the Owatonna Area Chamber of Commerce and Tourism. I thank you for the opportunity to speak to this bill today, and I thank Representative Keel for introducing this very important legislation. Basically, the number one issue that I hear with our members is about workforce. And we've heard about it from the state demographer earlier today, and I'm sure you hear it from your constituents as well. What this bill allows us to do is to be faster, more flexible, and more employer-friendly. So it built on an existing bill with the deed bill, and it allows us to inject more into this program, and it gives us greater flexibility in terms of providers. So one thing that I think is extremely important to note is the Minnesota Chamber has a program called Grow Minnesota, and over the last 11 years, we've spoken to over 8,000 businesses. And in that roll-up report last year, it talked about the fact that the number one issue that companies either leave Minnesota or choose to expand elsewhere is because they're closer to their suppliers. The number two issue is workforce. And the other resounding feedback was that the other issues that are problematic to them in terms of increased business costs become less of an issue. They hear less noise when their workforce needs are more are met at a greater level. And so by solving this issue for employers, we obviously look to retain more and substantiate more growth. I think it's very important to note that this bill would help us fill existing job vacancies. So we can talk about skills gap. We can talk about people being underemployed. We can talk about young students leaving our state. But this bill will help us in all of those areas. And the workforce is, frankly, a top issue in a number of strategic plans and companies around the state. Today, I'm very honored to speak on behalf of a fine businessman in our area named Cody Huber. And Mr. Huber is the vice president of Huber Supply Company. They supply welding products to large manufacturers, small manufacturers. They're a family-owned business. They were started in 1939, I believe in Iowa, but we won't highlight that. And then they saw a need from their customers. They needed more welders. And so rather than waiting for it to happen or not doing anything about it, they started a welding program in their community, in their business. So not only do they sell welding supplies, now they train welders. And they started that in 2013, and you should all have a handout that talks a little bit about what they offer. They offer, thank you, MIG welding, TIG welding, and weld symbol classes as well. His classes are frequently full, and if we were to pass a bill, certainly this would help Huber Supply, but more importantly, it would allow many other groups such as Huber Supply, many other companies, many other trainers, help us meet our workforce needs more effectively. And so I would be happy to stay for any other questions or go from there. But I think it's really important to look at the fact that there's a lot of rhetoric around workforce. This bill would actually allow us to do something about it.
Thank you. Representative Kiel, do you have any other invited testifiers?
No, I do not.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of this bill and move to member questions and comments. Member questions and comments, Representative Mahoney.
I'm not sure who needs to, well, I'll ask to the testifier. I don't understand how this bill bills on a deed program. What program was that?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, in a press release dated December 30th, 2014, it talked about the fact that they were rolling out the Job Training Incentive Pilot Program, an outgrowth of DEED's Minnesota Job Skills Partnership. And it talks about how they help small businesses train new workers and looks at some thresholds with employees and different things like that.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, one of the key words, there's a couple of key things in there. You talked about a pilot program, and I believe if I could call Deed down and ask when it started, but I'm pretty sure it just started in September or October, and or just recently anyhow, and they don't really know how this is working out. So essentially, are you really asking us to just skip the pilot and go directly to the, you know, and I don't think that was a tax credit either. So I think what I'm trying to get to is, you know, you're skipping a whole step in this process. We don't know if this training program that Deed has put into play actually works. So are you just asking us to go on faith that Deed did it right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I would certainly never be so bold as to ask you to go on faith. I certainly would say that I think one of the limitations of the pilot program that I don't want to wait for is the limitation of providers that we're allowed to use with that program. So I'm very interested in the flexibility piece of it, and I understand that it's not been necessarily proven yet, but I think, again, workforce is of a very timely concern.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's easy to skip a step when it is not the employer's money. It is the taxpayers' money, so I have some concerns there. The other piece, and I think this is for Representative Kiel, and I hope she, because this is a question I asked in the Greater Minnesota Committee, if she has an answer to it now, hopefully, why are you bypassing the Job Skills Partnership? I mean, there is absolutely no accountability in your bill, none. It's, if I'm an employer and I want to train my McDonald's grill cook, I get a tax break. If I'm Medtronic and I want to train my person that I've been training the same way for 30 years or paying for the last 30 years, I now get a tax cut. There's no accountability in this bill, Representative Kiel. Why do you want to get rid of the Job Skills Partnership?
Representative Kiel.
Yes, I remember this conversation.
Yes, you do, I'm sure.
Before we head into the question, we have an amendment that's been brought to the committee. This was brought on behalf by Ms. Newman. Ms. Newman, can you just explain what this amendment is first, because I don't want members being surprised by it.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Kiel, this was an amendment that was sent to you on March 5th. This is just a technical amendment, sort of the belt and suspenders variety, to clarify just some of the items in the bill. The first change would be on page 1, line 21, and it's just to clarify so that the statute would actually say that the business itself has to be, or the job has to be located in Minnesota, but outside of the metro area. Then page 1, line 23, the way the bill reads now, it could only apply to jobs that provide 32 hours of work a week, and this would say at least 32 hours per week. And then page 3 on line 5, it would clarify that the median wage requirement is for the county in which the job is located, so that there would be no question about whether it would be the employer's headquarters or where the employee is located or anything like that. So it's, this is strictly a technical and clarifying amendment.
And members, we did not post this amendment, so we need to waive the 24-hour rule. The chair is inclined to waive it, but I want to make sure there's no objections from members of the committee. Seeing none, we'll do that then. So, Representative Keel, do you have any comments on the amendment, or is it acceptable to you?
It's acceptable. Thank you.
Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Keel, to the original Mahoney question. Representative Mahoney, did you want to restate your question again, or do you remember what it was, Representative
Certainly.
Keel?
Certainly. I don't see any accountability in your bill. The Job Skills Partnership, we pour a lot of money into that particular organization. They are an organization made up of people who actually train people for a living, businessmen and women, business owners, and professionals at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. They go through a whole list of proposals, and they rate them, and they give out lots of money. I think it's several million dollars a biennium. Why not just add money? Well, why do you want to get bypass the Job Skills Partnership?
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mahoney, the intent is not to hurt the job partnership skills, and I believe the intent is not to. Deed is, I think, funded this, and you know what? I'm not going to explain this anymore. I am going to phone a friend. So I would like you to come explain it, Mr. Foreman.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record. Help yourself to a chair, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Dan Dorman, Executive Director, Greater Minnesota Partnership. What the bill does is it is patterned after a pilot program that Deed announced after the session last year. You may recall last year that Representative Ward carried this legislation, and I believe as it left your committee, there was $1 million, Representative Mahoney, I believe, as a pilot project for Representative Ward. So that is the same bill, so maybe you'll recall it from your own bill last year. What Deed did after session was take $1 million. They went to the Job Skills Partnership Board and said, we'd like to try a pilot project because we think that there is different ways to deliver job training. They thought it would be a good idea. And in fact, in one of your packets, you'll have a press release from Deed that talks about the success of it. They went to the Job Skills Partnership Board. The Job Skills Partnership Board said, here's $1 million to run your pilot program. The intent that I understand Deed has is to go back to the Job Skills Partnership Board and take $5 million from them to put into their program. What we're saying is, I think, like you, the Job Skills Partnership Board does good work. Rather than raid their existing funds, we thought that it made more sense to get a general fund appropriation so it does not harm the Job Skills Partnership Board. I assume that's why you supported it last year and included it in your omnibus bill with Representative Ward.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Dorman, I supported it because it was in last year's bill, we tried a whole host of new things. And we funded them in a way that asked Deed or whomever was going to run the program to go do it in a small area, see how it works, see what the problems are. You would think, having just spent, watched many times where a company or government tried to roll out a program statewide or industry-wide and had a fluff or a fumble, that was a good way to do it. And essentially what you're doing here is saying, let's go on a wing and a prayer and see if this actually works, which is, borders on, with taxpayers' dollars, being irresponsible. So, yes, I sent it out. I thought it was a great idea to try, I was happy to see where Deed was able to come up with the money to try it, but I thought we would see the results and then move forward. Also in that particular program, there were a whole lot of accountability pieces that are not in this bill. So don't call this bill, do not call this bill the same as the bill that went out last year, because that's an outright falsehood. And Mr. Chair, I would actually like to find out where Deed is on this particular bill and see if they think it's a good idea, or the governor likes it, or how their pilot program is going.
Well, we did solicit members of the public to testify, and there was no statement in favor or against. I'm hesitant to reopen public dialogue, public comment on this, but what I am going to do, and Representative Keel, and to the testifiers, you do not need to come back for the evening session. But my understanding is I misread my notes here, and actually this bill has to go to taxes. So I'm going to change the motion, and the chair is going to modify his motion that House File 751 be recommended to pass and referred to the Tax Committee. If members are comfortable voting on that now, we can do that. Otherwise, I'm going to hold this over, and we need to get to the Dabney bill. So any comments from members of the committee before we vote? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have House File 751 recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Keel. And we'll wait for Representative Dabney. Otherwise, if Representative, is there somebody here who wants to maybe start the introduction for Representative Dabney's bill while we're waiting for him? There he is. All right.
He's been waiting there.
We've been waiting for an hour, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, if I could tell you the story about the interaction I just had with former Speaker Kelleher, I think you'd enjoy it and you'd excuse me, but it would be impolite, so I won't.
Will you tell me later?
I can tell you later. Sure. Offline.
The chair will move House File 402 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. House File 402 is a simple bill that repeals the state rule that currently allows employers to charge tipped employees, servers and bartenders, credit card transaction fees against the tip portion of the bill, where the customer pays both the restaurant charge and the tip on their credit card or debit card. Keep in mind that this practice only charges the transaction fee on the tip portion of the transaction. So let me pull this out for folks. For example, you go out to dinner, you have a $50 tab at the end of the meal, you leave a $10 tip, you process both of these on your credit card. The restaurant then charges the transaction fee only against that $10 tip portion of the credit card transaction. This usually ranges anywhere between 0.5% to 3%, and there may be a small flat fee like 10 cents to the transaction, being charged again against the tip, not against the underlying bill. In other words, restaurants that do this are literally nickel and diming their employees. Mother Dabney, however, taught me to watch the nickels and dimes, and the quarters and dollars will take care of themselves. And this practice by restaurants can cost employees hundreds of dollars a year that they earned through their efforts and the tips that they received. The rule allows restaurants to charge their employees for a routine cost of doing business. We don't allow restaurants to charge staff for fees that the restaurant may pay for taking checks. We don't allow them to charge in the instance of counterfeit money if they're taking cash for a transaction. We don't allow them to charge the dishwasher for the cost of soap, the cook for the cost of pots and pans, or the host or hostess for the cost of the very credit card swipe machine that they use to charge me for my meal and tip. Further, other retailers don't engage in this practice. The grocery store doesn't deduct from the cashier's wages when I pay for my groceries with a credit card. Neither does the dry cleaner or any other Main Street retailer. Nine other states and several major cities already prohibit this practice, and I hope that Minnesota can become the 10th state to do so. With me today, Mr. Chair, I have Wade Lunenberg from Unite HERE, Jennifer Schaubach from the AFL-CIO, and I believe Ginger Jensen is also here subbing in for Chris Jacobs, who's out ill.
Okay, and do we need to hear from each of the testifiers, or have you kind of summarized their comments and we can, maybe they'll be available for questions?
Why don't we see what they can do? Maybe Ms. Jensen. Oop, nothing like putting the civilian on the spot.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Neuberger.
Did I miss this, or was there an amendment that we needed to adopt, or did I miss that? I'm seeing A1 an A1 amendment.
We will be adopting the A1 amendment, but...
Thank you.
Representative Dabney, the A1 amendment. Which member of the committee authored this amendment? Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman? This amendment certainly does something to make things a little more equitable to the owner. 80% of the transactions in the restaurant are now using credit cards, and the cost of that, along with the increased cost in minimum wage and server's cost, is appreciable. So we have this amendment that simply inserts after gratuity inserts received by employer from a card processor. So we can keep track of the ones per person, and we can equitably charge that portion to against the employee's tips, the way I understand it.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'm not entirely sure that I understand the A1 amendment, okay. But if I understand what Representative Gunther just said, the A1 amendment is opposite in the intention of this bill, because he seems to be saying that this would allow us to equitably, in his words, charge the cost of the transaction fee, the interchange fee, against the employee, and I believe that this is a cost of doing business.
Representative Dabney, I will read the language as it exists today, and then I'll read it as it would be modified. Under your bill right now, it says, where a gratuity is given by a customer through a debit charge or credit card, the full amount of gratuity must be allowed the employee. What the amendment would do is change that so that after the word gratuity, the following amount that is insert, this is just added to the language, nothing's deleted, so it would read as follows. Where a gratuity is given by a customer through a debit charge or credit card, the full amount of the gratuity received by the employer from the card processor must be allowed the employee. So Representative Gunther, if you want to explain.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Picture this. In your left hand is a credit card charge form, including a tip of $10.21 from a $10 transaction. On your right hand is a $10 bill. The difference between the cost of the credit card or debit card processing who should pay for the processing or getting this charge, getting the charge to the cash, the person who gets the cash or the employer. And if you'd like, we could have Representative McElroy further explain the process.
So before we before we take action on the A1 amendment, I do want to hear from the testifier. We'll have public comments, and then we'll we're over our time, but I'm going to try to go faster. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thanks. My name is Ginger Jensen, and again, I'll try and be quick since we're over time. But I've been a tipped restaurant worker for most of my working life. I've worked for large chains and small businesses. And despite the narrative that big business attempts to push tipped workers are not kids trying to make a quick buck, we are professionals who are the face of the business we serve. And in an economy when most low-wage and service sector workers have saddled the economic recovery on their backs, business doesn't need any more breaks. Business will lobby for every opportunity to take more away from workers. On the whole, service workers are a section of the workforce shouldering a disproportionate burden, many of us also going to school and raising families, expenses which aren't factored always in determining a living wage. Interchange fees should not be part of an employer's cost of, or should be part of an employer's cost of doing business. Tips are not available funds to give employers a break. to deduct interchange fees from servers targets one classification of worker who happens to collect money for a transaction, a deduction which adds up quickly and amounts to several hundreds of dollars annually lost from those workers. We can't control whether a customer pays with cash or a card, and fundamentally, workers should not be punished in their pocketbooks for a job well done if an employer doesn't have their business costs in line. The majority of low-wage service workers are women as well, and the reality of transaction fees means employers are further exacerbating the gender pay gap. And in rural areas and in greater Minnesota, the minimum wage increase that workers have already fought for will go straight back into transaction fees. I also wanted to present to committee members a letter from Laurel, who is also a tipped server. She wasn't able to be here today, but she wanted to be able to testify. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This is a public hearing. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? And Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, just hold on.
Good afternoon.
Okay, hold on a second. I thought we were wrapping up things. I guess we're not. So I'm looking for some direction from you, Representative Dabney, of how you want to approach this.
You just want to state your support?
Sure. Okay, sorry. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
It'll be brief.
Thank you.
Chair Garofalo and committee members, my name is Wade Luneberg with Unite Here. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Hotel Employees Union here in the Twin Cities in Bloomington. Today I do urge your support of House File 402.
Thank you.
Jennifer Schaubach, I'm the Legislative Director at the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We stand behind our restaurant workers and have fought very hard to get a minimum wage increase, and we don't want to see restaurants further subsidized by taking credit card fees out of servers' tips. As Representative Dabney stated, that's a cost of doing business, and I don't think any other business, grocery, if you go see a movie, they're not going to deduct fees when you ask someone to run your card. And we would also oppose the A1 amendment that would be.
Thank you. Representative Dabney, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not.
Thank you. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. My name is Shayna Nienau. I am the Human Resources Director for Cascade Hospitality. We operate the Crave restaurants and other brands here in Minnesota. I also have been in the restaurant industry for 20 years and worked about 7 of those as a tipped employee. I'm here today to provide some information and perspective regarding the credit card fees that restaurants are required to pay. It sounds like there may be some misconceptions regarding credit card fees, and here are the basic facts. Credit card fees are not optional. Restaurants are required to pay the processing fees taken by credit card companies. Restaurants are not taking anything from their employees. These credit card fees come off the top before restaurants receive funds from the card processor. Restaurants do not charge servers for the credit card fee on the entire bill. The fee charged by the credit card processor is proportional to the food or drink tab and the tip. The credit card fees are a shared responsibility between the employer and the employee. We want our employees to be successful and earn as much money as they can. Good tips mean our customers and staff are happy. The reality is that over 95% of our transactions in our restaurants use credit cards. Credit cards are convenient and easy to use, but when we accept them, we accept the terms of the processing agreement. The Minnesota Restaurant Association does not support House File 402 as written. However, we do support it in the language if the language is clarified to explain that the tip amount is the amount received by the employer from the card processor. Thank you for the opportunity to share this information with you today.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion and move to members. Representative Gunther?
Mr. Chairman, at this time, because this bill is going to be laid over anyway, I will withdraw this amendment, and that way we can get this committee over close to being on time.
Okay, any other comments from members of the committee or questions?
Not anymore, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney, did you wish to have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to have House File 402 heard. It's not a complicated bill or a complicated situation. If I leave a $10 tip on a credit card for the server or the bartender, I expect them to get $10. Cost of doing business is a cost of doing business, and I don't see a rationale for servers to have money taken out of their wallets by their employer because I happen to choose, out of their control of the server, that I'm paying on a credit card.
A question.
Thank you,
before we adjourn, a question for staff or from the businesses. Are the businesses required to have a credit card transaction fee that allows for the item on a tip there, or does the business have the discretion of simply allowing for the cost of the meal to be the item on there and there's no tip delineated on it? I think I know the answer to that question, but does anyone know the provide that for the record? No one wants to provide that answer? Oh, don't know? Representative Davney, that might be something to kind of watch out for, because I'm pretty sure I know the answer to that question, and I don't think they have to put tip on the credit card. I don't think the employer has to do that. So that we all have unintended side effects of bills, but I look forward to working with the author going forward. I think I have another piece of legislation that perhaps could address both these issues together.
All right. thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. With that, the Chair renews his motion to have House File 402 laid over for possible inclusion. Members, we are back at 6:30 in room 10 right here, so please, take your documents, put them in your folder for your saved items, and then we'll be back at 6:30. Members, with that, we are in recess. We have the Committee of Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy and Finance. Representative Smith moves approval of the minutes dated March 9th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, the first bill on our agenda is a Representative Erdahl bill. The Chair will move House File 484 for possible inclusion of a later bill. Representative Erdahl, do you have an amendment for your bill?
Do I have an amendment for my bill? Yes, I do.
Okay. Is it the... Because I don't have it, so... Does anyone have an amendment to 484 in their packet? Oh, with you. Well, then let's dispense with the pleasantries here, and we'll extend the topic. Do we have copies of this for the whole committee?
We should.
No. Okay. Well.
the amendment.
Hold on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
The long amendment.
It's long enough that it can't be verbal. Ms. Hendricks, can you please explain the amendment to the committee?
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so what this amendment does, there was an issue that was raised in the fiscal note that the appropriation, the language of the bill also includes money coming from the bond proceeds fund, and that would not that couldn't happen. So this amendment kind of fixes that. So it would include on page 1, line 11, after the period, insert an appropriation from the general fund may be used as a cost share for federal disaster assistance for privately owned capital improvement projects. So this would fix that concern.
Yes, that's my amendment.
Representative Mahoney, you know, we have a written copy of it, but are you okay with us orally adopting that amendment right now, or do you want to wait for the writing to show up?
If comfortable, read it again. I think we
can. Okay, Ms. Hendricks.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so this was an amendment that came from staff. It actually came from the Fiscal Analysis Department, John Waltz, and Public Safety. And so this would insert on page 1, line 11, after the period, insert, an appropriation from the general fund may be used as a cost share for federal disaster assistance for privately owned capital improvement projects.
The goal, Representative Mahoney? Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think we should be able to move on with that. And I've got a question for staff when we're...
All right. The Chair will move that amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mahoney.
So, Mr. Chair, and this is to staff, Ms. Hendrick, on line 1.9, an appropriation from the bond proceeds may be used as cost share for federal disaster assistance for public Okay, no, I understand it. It's the word public I didn't see. Thank you.
So the bill is now in the form the author would like. Representative Erdahl, to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my bill, House File 484. Under federal law, certain private nonprofit organizations are eligible to receive FEMA grants for disaster relief. FEMA provides disaster aid to nonprofits under its public assistance program, mostly to states and local government units. Eligible private nonprofits are those that provide critical services in the event of a disaster. Our rural electric co-ops were created in 1935. They provide critical services, electricity to Minnesota. Nonprofit utility co-ops are eligible for FEMA public disaster aid because they provide critical services in a disaster area as defined in federal law. The state matches FEMA aid to local government units, state agencies, and tribes. It doesn't match FEMA aid to nonprofits. FEMA may currently provide up to 75% of the recipient's disaster cost. Co-ops, states, and local government units are responsible for the remaining 25%. The state of Minnesota pays part or all of the remaining 25% of eligible cost for the local government unit. The legislature appropriates money to the Department of Public Safety, who distribute it. Co-ops are eligible for the state FEMA match or the new state aid program for local government units from last year. They are also eligible for DEEDS business disaster relief, but this is not funded by the legislature for each disaster and is unpredictable. I want to make utility cooperatives eligible for this disaster relief. Only utility co-ops are eligible in my amendment, not social services or others who might be eligible for FEMA funding. And that's what it does.
Representative Erdahl, do you have any additional invited testifiers you'd like to have speak right now?
Yes, I do.
I'll have them come down. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Tim Mergen with Meeker Cooperative Light and Power in Litchfield, Minnesota. And again, Mr. Chair and representatives, thank you for allowing me to come forward tonight. I'd like to tell you I'm here on behalf of our 7,500 members, owners that make up Meeker Cooperative, and all the cooperative owners across the state. A little background on Meeker Cooperative. We primarily serve residential and grain livestock farm-based membership. We're headquartered in Litchfield, as I said, and we distribute electricity to our members in six counties, and they are Meeker, Renville, McLeod, Candiohi, Wright, and Stearns, with about 75% of all those members in Meeker County. We maintain 12 substations and 1,928 miles of line. And those miles of line equate to 4,127 miles of wire that we maintain, which is enough wire to run from here to the Panama Canal. So we have about 1.8 members per mile of wire. Briefly, we were affected by three major storms in July of 2011. Was our first one, and that hit our southern portion of our service territory. Then in June of 2012, we were hit with another major storm that hit basically the north and central part of our service territory. And then a year later, in June of 2013, the northwestern portion of our service territory was hit by another storm. All three of these storms were considered or were declared major disasters and eligible for FEMA funding. But again, the FEMA funding only covered 75% of the total of damages that were eligible for the FEMA funding. And I'm here asking this committee to move this bill forward so that we would be eligible to receive the last 25%, just as municipal systems are. Our members pay the taxes in this state just as well as municipal utility members, and the way it's currently set up, they're never eligible to receive their tax dollars back in the form of disaster relief to help get their electricity back up and going. And I think we can all agree in today's world, electricity is an essential service that needs to be provided. So I ask you to move this bill and I'll answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll complete the public testimony portion, and then if you're available for questions, and we'll call you back up. Thank you very much. Representative Erdahl, any other invited testifiers before we go to the public? This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Mr. Johnson, you don't have a position on the bill? With that, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and go to member questions. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment. Lion Lincoln Electric was serves a large part of my district, and just a while back they were hit with a major storm, which took out their main building, their garage that services the line. So that took 4 or 5 hours just to be able to get their trucks out of the building after the storm to start serving their customers. So I want to just thank Representative Erdahl for moving this bill forward. I think it'll make a difference for a lot of our rural utilities. Thank you.
Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've actually had similar damage in a few tornadoes we had a few years back. Lake Country Power dealt with a significant amount of lines down and could definitely use some help for those ratepayers that they couldn't get.
Representative Mahoney. Which of your rural co-ops had a disaster that were affected by the...
Yeah, we're just the bank. We're just the bank, you know. Representative Erdahl or Mr. Mergen?
Mergen, correct.
Mergen. Maybe you can give me a few examples of what... Well, maybe better yet, how about if I phrase it this way? What damage in a storm... Lines down, poles down, trucks blown over, whatever. What would not now be eligible for FEMA or state reimbursement? What would not be eligible?
Representative, you mean under current law or with this change
with
in law?
With this bill.
With this change in law. Okay.
Yeah, with so the to the change in law.
To the testifier,
Mr. Chair and Representative. There really wouldn't be anything that would not be eligible. If you're talking as far as equipment, poles, wires as not being eligible, pretty much anything you see when you drive down the road that's distribution related would be eligible for funding through this bill.
I think a more appropriate, Representative Mahoney, my understanding of the bill as I read it was that it would be the same limitations that exist on state agencies and local units of government. So whatever limitations are currently in place under 12.221, that would be the limitations that apply to cooperatives. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have House File 484 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you for testifying. And Representative Erdahl, the chair likes your bill.
Thank you very much.
Next we got Representative Smith. And members, just so you know the order, we got Representative Smith, then Representative Clark, and then Albright, then Gunther. That's the plan. If there's problems with that, Representative Gunther, if you need to go sooner, okay. I figure you're on the committee, so.
Mr. Chair, a couple of weeks ago, Representative Mahoney was here and brought cookies from his district, and I sent cookies to the right staff
there we go.
From my
right
district.
Right there. There you go. Good move. Help you with that.
Isaacson votes aye.
Mr.
Chair.
One and a half, that's right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney before Representative Smith moves his bill.
I just want to say that actually wasn't from my district. I believe it was from Representative Clark's district.
Oh,
but nice. What I will say is that the bakery was is up for a James Beard Award.
Oh.
Yeah, so we were treated pretty special, and I'm sure that these are going to be almost as good as the James Beard Award. So
please withhold your judgment. They may even be better.
All right. Representative Smith, I think you got a motion to make.
Yes, I move House File 1416, a move before this committee.
For a possible inclusion in a later bill, and do you have any amendments? It does not appear so.
No amendments.
All right, Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill dealing with the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, it is expected, the trust fund balance is expected to be $1.6 billion by January 1st of 2016. The balance as of February 14th this year was $1.45 billion. In the interest of not having the fund become larger than it needs for Minnesota, stakeholders met and this bill was developed. This bill reduces the base rate from 0.1% to 0.07%. and reduces the taxable wages from $30,000 per year to approximately $26,000 per year. These two elements would start January 1st, 2016. This is expected to have the impact on the trust fund balance by about $120 million per year. This bill has a collar mechanism so the trust fund doesn't get too high while still protecting the financial integrity of the trust fund. This bill has bipartisan support in the House and in the Senate. And I would like my testifier to speak now, Benjamin Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber.
Please introduce yourself, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for having me here today, and thank you to the members of both parties that have signed on to this bill and are supporting it. This is an important bill. I'd like to start off by thanking DEET staff. I worked closely with them, even though through the process they actually helped me draft this language. We were hoping actually for a $300 to $400 million tax cut, so this actually comes in lower than what we had discussed with them. But so while we'd like to see that higher, I do appreciate the help that they had given me in drafting the language. They are experts in the fund, and I'd also like to point out we've actually had them on U.S. chamber calls because our fund is actually one of the most well-run in the country, and reacted very quickly to the way it was set up, reacted very quickly to the downturn, so we were able to actually recover from the recession very quickly, and we had a tax cut 2 years, or it moved up a tax cut that was scheduled to occur anyways, to kind of give some relief to businesses that were already paying in. We brought this bill forward because just as the fund has automatic mechanisms as it declines, so if we're going into a recession, there is no actual triggers or cuts that are triggered when the fund gets too high. As Representative Smith said, you look at the rosy projections from even Deed about how great our economy is, as well as from our state agencies that they expect continued economic growth, our fund will likely be upwards of $1.6 billion by January 1st of next year. And so that's even more money than the very conservative number that the federal government thinks our fund should be at based on their mechanisms. So the danger of having the fund too high is pretty substantial. While it's against federal law to take money out of the fund, money can be diverted for other purposes. I don't want to give anyone any ideas in this committee, but
that's hard to figure out how to do it, but
And it hasn't been done before, and we don't want that precedent to be set. And also it's important to return that money back to the employers across the state to do things like reinvest in their businesses, their employees, and that money goes back into the local economy. So while these, it really depends on the amount of employees you have and the wages that they're paid, how significant these cuts would be. But we think just having them and reducing the fund to a very reasonable level is important. We submitted a letter, it should be in your packets, on behalf of various different business groups across the state that support this, including Hospitality Minnesota, NFIB, some individual business owners, and the Minnesota Business Partnership, as well as the grocers and the retailers. So this will touch a lot of different people across the state, and we think it's a good idea.
Thank you. Representative Smith, do you have any other invited testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Rick Caligiuri. I'm the Director of Unemployment at Deed. Deed is opposing this bill because we believe that a UI tax cut is not warranted at this time. In the 2013 legislative session, the legislature and the governor implemented a two-year UI tax cut of approximately $350 million for the years 2014 and 2015. when you factor in an 18% decrease in experience rates this year, the total tax cut to employers for 2014 and 2015 is $593 million. Cutting the taxable wage base will significantly increase socialized costs in the UI system, and it will provide a tax break for the approximately over 9,000 employers who are at the maximum experience rate. Basically, when you hit the cap on the experience rate, any additional unemployment costs are borne by the other employers, and this will increase. This will increase socialized costs. We oppose setting a cap on the trust fund that is the same trigger for the first tax increase. The U.S. Department of Labor has set a recommended solvency level for states, which is higher than this, and we have just hit this level for the first time ever. Despite the fact that we have just a little under $1.4 billion in the trust fund right now, I assure you that that trust fund can go down rapidly. We paid out $1.7 billion in benefits from our trust fund in 2009, and then another $1.4 billion in 2010. And we only recovered from debt in our trust fund in April of 2012. The concept of a cap on Minnesota's unemployment insurance trust fund has huge public policy implications on Minnesota's workforce and Minnesota's employers. We believe this public policy issue needs to be thoroughly vetted, and we recommend that this go before the UI Advisory Council.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Go ahead. If you want to testify, just come up. If I want to say no, I'll stop. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Schottbach. I am the legislative director of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And I know Representative Garofalo does not like to see me up here.
That's not true. I'm always happy to see you here. Yeah. That's not true at all.
So I am here today to testify in opposition to House File 1416.
That'll complete your testimony today. Thank you. We'll move on to... No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We need the, you know, levity at this time of the night, right?
We do.
Well, this bill does, like Rick testified, essentially just further reduce UI taxes by cutting the taxable wage base as well as the base rate. After businesses saw a decrease in their UI taxes last session, which was agreed upon by the UI Advisory Council. It also imposes a cap on the UI Trust Fund. The trust fund should have enough to meet our immediate obligations, plus some cushion just to absorb an increase in benefit payouts, like in 2009 that we saw when there's an economic downturn, and when our tax structure can actually begin to respond. So because of the delayed nature of the funding structure, it can be nearly 2 years before the funding mechanism can respond to a downturn. Our trust fund recovered from the recession well, as Rick mentioned, and is currently near the level that the USDOL considers to be ideal. This bill could have major ramifications for Minnesota workers, employers, the stability of the trust fund, and the UI program in general. Any changes to the formula deserve careful and detailed analysis. An issue of this importance should be appropriately vetted so as not to cause serious unintended consequences that harm our workers, our employers, and go through the UI Advisory Council process. Thank you for your time, and I would stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion. We'll move to questions from members. We got Metza, Isaacson, and Guther. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rick, you mind coming down for... So I guess I'll start off with a question while I'm sitting. My question would be, we've got a recession that we just went through. We've got Target announcing its layoffs. We've had some recent layoffs up on the range. When we have a high-paying income and there's a layoff, does that draw from the fund at a higher rate?
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Metza, any significant anomalies that would happen in the economy, whether they be several large mass layoffs or an unusually early or severe winter could have significant impact on the funds level.
What is the maximum monthly benefit? Is that maybe it's pay period benefit that a person
the maximum weekly benefit amount in Minnesota is currently $640 a week.
A week. Okay.
You would have to make about $67,000 a year in order to make the maximum weekly benefit amount.
Right. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think to make a long story short and to keep things moving along, my point's going to be. Right now, my district's going through some volatile global climates in regard to steel prices or prices on the open market. I think it'd be very irresponsible of us to let this not go through the advisory council process. Many of the members would qualify at that high level in my district, and it would, in my mind, I remember when I was making not nearly $67,000 a year, and filed for some benefits. The check wasn't that big, but I'd imagine if we had thousands of layoffs come through, that it would drain pretty quickly. And I would appreciate the state taking and doing its due diligence to make sure that in these cases we do have the funding and that it at least go through that process and get some of the recommendations from that board.
So can we run through the balances for me right now, where we were, where we're at, and where we're going?
As of this week, we're a little bit under $1.4 billion, $1.39 as of this week. It fluctuates. I mean, in the winter, in our busy season, with all of construction layoffs, et cetera, we can pay out $23 to $25 million a week.
And so what's the sort of the seasonal, and obviously the general economic conditions matter quite a bit, but what is the general wave of when receipts are at their highest and when they're at their lowest? In terms of
generally
balance.
Speaking, we take in about 40% of our revenue after the first quarter, so that's in April we would see that revenue come in, and then it steadily declines through the rest of the year.
So in terms of the balance that's actually in the account, what month would it be at its lowest?
It would be at its lowest point at March 31st. That's when we have in statute that we. Look at the fund on March 31st. So you would have had your winter payouts. It's before the first quarter receipts come in.
Okay. And help me understand, the mechanism in current law right now is, at what point do rates go up or we start collecting revenue automatically?
The rates go up at the cap level that's set in this bill. If it's below that level, the rate will go up to the next level in the base UI tax.
And what is that cap amount? What is that floor amount? At what point do we turn this stuff back on?
In the bill, it's 0.75% of total taxable wages. And so this year, that's a little over $1 billion. Next year, it'll be about $1.1
billion. Okay. So right now, under current law, if it goes to, I'll just say, I know you didn't say this, but about $1 billion,
mm-hmm.
then the rates automatically kick it.
If it's under that amount, the rate goes up.
Okay. And so at what point when it's going up do we automatically blink it off? Just annually every March 31st?
Yes, annually. And it goes up, it triggers up, and then triggers down.
Okay. And the changes that Representative Smith is proposing are that what happens at what level? But it's going down. What changes is he proposing?
Well, basically, it as long as it is below the 0.75 level, which we think it will be, it will almost permanently kick in this lower level in the taxable wage base.
So, but what does the UI balance have to be at before the tax reductions in Representative Smith's bill would blink off and we would increase the rates?
Again, it would have to be over that amount. By March 31st of 2016, again, it would have to be $1.1 billion. If it's under $1.1 billion, this kicks in. Or if it's under $1.1 billion, the tax rate increases. If it's over, then this goes into effect.
So whether we change your law or not, let's just say bad things happen, right? Whether we change the law or not, tax increases would kick in at the same time?
That's correct.
Okay, so help me understand. I guess I thought there was more consensus on this bill than is being presented to me tonight. So why would that jeopardize the UI trust? I don't understand. Why would there be a jeopardy?
This will make the trust fund, Mr. Chair, this will make the trust fund lower.
But if it falls below $1 billion, it automatically gets a tax increase and goes back up, whether we change the law or not.
But it takes time.
That is true. I mean, it does kick in the tax rate, but it still reduces the taxable wage base, and then it redistributes who pays the taxes, and then more of the taxes will go toward the experience rate.
Okay, but the concerns that we heard from testifiers was that this was going to jeopardize benefits, or we were more likely to go into a deficit. But in terms of the floor of the trust fund, it doesn't sound like there's much of a difference, right? In fact, it doesn't sound like there's a difference at all. If you want to go ahead and talk, you don't have to.
Mr. Chair?
Hold on one second. That's my.
Great. If I understand your question, Mr. Chair, there would be no cushion for the tax increase then.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, Kim Babine. I am Director of Government Affairs at DEED, and Rick is the expert on this. I just am going to try and interpret the question differently. So the current law, when the trust fund goes below the basically about $1 billion threshold, so the 0.75 that's in law, so depending on the taxable wages, when it goes below the about $1 billion, then that's when our tax system, the three-part system, when taxes start to tick up. There is no, if the fund, things are healthy, things are going up, just like our trust fund is right now, it's 1.4. The bill proposes that there would be kind of a high water mark on that, except for, and that's a valid public policy consideration. We can consider that since the trust fund is doing well at this point. We would argue that it needs to be vetted and we need to get a little bit more detail. The bill, however, sets that high water mark at the same level as the low water mark. So about $1 billion, tax under about $1 billion, if it's under, you know, $900 million, then the taxes tick up. If it's just above, taxes tick down, which there's no cushion for when we get to that high water mark. Or that high water mark is the same as the low water mark.
And what is the, and I know it's measured as a percent, but what is the dollar amount for the cap right now in terms of how big would the trust fund have to get before we would blink on that tax reduction?
Mr. Chair, there currently is no cap on the unemployment insurance trust fund. This issue has never come up before. We've never been at this level. Again, we've just, for the first time in history, hit the recommended solvency level that the U.S. Department of Labor recommends.
And go ahead, testifier.
Mr. Chair, members, and exactly, we have not been in this situation before, so we've had discussions with members, with the chamber, with others, saying that this is, since we're in this situation that we find ourselves in, let's have that conversation about, you know, what the high water mark should be. We've committed to discussing that at next year's UI Advisory Council to be able to give it its full vetting. So no cap right now.
Okay, so in terms of the cap as Representative Smith is proposing, what is that approximate dollar amount based off of current wages?
This year, it's, Mr. Chair, this year it's about $1 billion, just a titch over $1 billion. Next year it'll be just...
But no, the top-end cap.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
So the top-end cap is $1 billion, and the bottom-end cap, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, the members, at one point, this bill says that if the trust fund is above $1.0 billion, the taxable wage rate is 0.07%, and the wages are at $25,000. If the trust fund falls below $1.0 billion in today's dollars, the rate goes back to what it was today, which is 0.1 base rate and $25,000.
Okay, so to the testifier, I thought there was more consensus on this than apparently there is, but so is it a philosophical aversion to any top cap at all? Or is it the level
that's... Mr. Chair, no, I think that's a very viable policy, public policy discussion, but it's never come up before.
Okay, so what would be a viable cap amount? On the top end, not on the bottom. I understand the bottom, but on the
Mr.
top.
Mr. Chair, do you want my opinion? I think that the
Department
of Labor's recommendation of basically a 1%, which is a quarter of a percent higher than the cap here, which is the rate we're at right now, would be a viable.
And that what would that turn in terms of dollar amount? What would that be?
About $1.4 billion now.
$1.4 billion. Okay, Mr. Gerber, I see you're up here. Representative Metz, I think you have the floor. We'll come back to you. I promise. I just Mr. Gerber.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I brought this issue to Deed staff well before the first of the year. I don't think time is really the issue. I asked them to, if really the only concern was that it has not been vetted through the council, which, by the way, multiple bills have passed through the locked out workers was a huge major policy change that probably violated federal law. Actually, the governor's tax cut, which I have some literature here from Mark Dayton's office, which actually we had much less in the fund when that cut was initiated. So if this is dangerous, that was even more dangerous. That didn't go through the advisory council. To me, that's really not a legitimate concern. I asked for a meeting. There wasn't. They said they wouldn't hold a meeting during the session. But you know, I'm happy to sit down. I've offered to sit down and talk about this with them. So that offer is on the table. But when we looked at it, you know, the $1.4 billion, the average high-cost multiple, is the formula that the federal government uses. It's uniform across all 50 states. Our state is set up a lot differently, so you're taking a uniform number and applying it to our state. There's a lot of other states that don't have these type of triggers that we do. A lot of other states are still paying off debt when we were able to recover quickly from it. So we think having too much money in the fund is a bad thing. That money should be back in the pockets of the businesses in this state. You know, on the flip side, when we did go into the deficit, and I'm not suggesting that we want to put ourselves in a position where we would have to borrow, the federal government did waive the interest for a substantial amount of time. I believe it was about 2 years. So, you know, that the risk that, you know, borrowing money is so awful in this context, I think, is really overblown. Businesses borrow money all the time. Again, I'm not saying that we want to put ourselves in that position, but this bill doesn't do that. It still provides for adequate reserves in the fund and protects the what we believe is the viability of the fund while making sure that we don't have too much in reserves.
Okay, so just to be clear, though, the difference in opinion here is whether these taxes should automatically blink off at $1 billion or $1.4 billion. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, you heard, and I don't want to...
Yes? Okay, is that an accurate statement, what I just said? Accurate, not inaccurate statement?
Mr. Chair, I think the tax is blinking on and off. In a perfect world, if there were a cap, wouldn't have anything to do with a cap. A cap would just be a point at which there would be some other kind of mechanism by which we credit the employers or whatever. But right now, the taxes are triggered by the level of the fund, and it starts at 0.7, and then it keeps going up, and then they trigger off again. And it seems that it worked pretty well during the recession because all of the taxes went up to the maximum, and then there was even an additional assessment that went into play, and then things were triggering off, and then the tax cut that the legislature and the governor passed was due to the fact that we recovered so well and that we projected very high balances, even higher than what we have now. And so that was kind of a move to kind of proactively reduce the fund. It actually would be another $350 million or so higher than it is right now.
Okay. It doesn't sound like actually people are – it sounds like people agree that if there's too much money in the fund, we should cut rates so businesses can hold on to their money. The dispute is the mechanism for how we're giving the money back to businesses and the method in which we do it and what the amount of money is. I don't think there's actually as big of a conflict as is being presented here, that we all agree we should be reducing these taxes when there's extra money in the bank. So I guess I'm not trying to, but if we want to keep fighting, I guess we can. Yeah, to the testifier, go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
you know, Jennifer Schaubach again from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, I think Ben kind of argued our point for us in that states back during the recession that went into massive deficit, their funds became insolvent. The majority of those that are still paying it back and have been paying the feds their fees forever, unlike ours, were states that had low taxable wage base. 20 of the 33 states had wage bases of $10,000 or less. 26 of them had bases less than $15,000. And of the states that there were only 13 states that were actually projected to hopefully stay solvent in 2010, and those were the ones that have indexed taxable wage bases like ours. So, you know, the trust fund problems are, you know, exacerbated by, you know, neglecting these sound financial principles. And so why would we go and lower rates? We agree. I think I would say we agree that there is a level at which, you know, the trust fund gets to where we need to figure out some sort of mechanism to tick it down. And like I said, we agreed on the tax credit back to employers during last session at the UI Advisory Council. I think we have a great working relationship in that council. But I think if we move ahead with lowering the taxable wage base and doing all of these things and not really looking at what we're doing, we could end up in a really bad spot.
Why does the AFL-CIO support a tax credit for businesses versus a lower rate?
Well, like I said, that's what I'm saying is the solvency level, right, the level of the trust fund. We supported that as an option. We supported ticking. Actually, it was not a tax rebate. It was lowering the rate for business, I believe, last year that gave them the tax break of $350 million.
Mr. Gerber?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and I think I don't think you argued my – I didn't argue your point. But I think you saw we still have double, you know, what a lot of these other states. I don't think we would want to go to that level. I'm not suggesting we do that. I think it sounds like we do agree. I've asked for them to bring forward – you know, the issue is it's a very complicated fund. They're the experts. If they have a better idea on how to do this, I've already asked them to bring that forward. I haven't received anything. I'd love to hear their proposal on how to adjust the level on the fund to an appropriate amount. I think right now we have way too much. And if we don't act now, by January 2016, but if we don't act now, we won't be able to do anything until 2017 because of the way the legislative session set up. So I think we need to find something soon. And if it's, you know, I guess the onus is on them. If they don't like this, then bring something forward that works.
I'm going to go to Representative Metzger because I butted in line long enough here. But I just, I have a difficult time thinking that $1 billion in savings is risky when we were bragging about $1.2 billion in savings last year in the UI fund. So that's just, I think that there's probably time for parties to reach an agreement on this and determine how much taxes we're going to cut and how much lower those rates will be. Representative Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's the longest I've had the floor and the least I've said ever.
We keep it that way? Or?
we can. You know, I think this comes down to, again, just having something that works for working families. I know Representative Neuberger's district, with some of our new regulations coming through, we could have 400 layoffs pretty easily in a very short period of time. My district could be the same way. This isn't about giving the money back to the businesses now. For me, they're going to get this back when it triggers off. And so this is about being fiscally responsible as Minnesotans to make sure that when our neighbors and friends and family are out of work, that check's coming. And we aren't borrowing from the federal government. And, you know, I think that we can do our due diligence on it. My guess, Mr. Gerber, is that they didn't think there need to be an adjustment on it, which is why they're opposing the bill today. And, you know, I think that's pretty clear. They didn't bring forward middle ground because they want to keep it the way it is right now because it worked when we were at our worst, and we should keep it there. We made some adjustments last year, $350 million back into the pockets of business owners, and I think I'll leave it there.
Okay. Representative Isaacson, then Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure that I follow the argument from Mr. Gerber that something was really dumb we did before, and this is slightly less dumb, so now we should do this idea now. I don't think that quite makes sense to me with regards to how we're looking at this. And what I want to have a question for Rick, is it? What is the function of the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council?
Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, members, the Advisory Council does just that. It advises the department and the administration relative to issues of policy relative to the unemployment insurance program.
So,
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. So would this be the kind of thing that typically they would have a hearing on and have a discussion about and maybe give us some advice?
Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, this is our position is that it really should be thoroughly vetted. There are probably a lot of different mechanisms at play. It's very complicated, and we would like it to go through that advisory council where all the relative parties that have vested interest in this kind of policy are at the table.
Representative Isaacson.
And am I correct in assuming that you are not, as we've said, completely in disagreement with Mr. Gerber's position in the sense that a cap may be necessary to make sure that we keep the money in the pockets of businesses at the same time having a robust safety net for when we have unemployment insurance? Is that correct?
Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. I think that's a viable public policy discussion.
So, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask, if this has not been vetted by an organization called the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, whose sole job is to manage this kind of thing, and there is clearly not consensus here on how it's supposed to work, it seems incomprehensible that we would pass a bill that would do something that doesn't take into account the stakeholders.
Well, two things, Representative Isaacson. Number one, we're laying this bill over for possible inclusion. We're not voting on the bill today. Second of all, Mr. Gerber, what other items has the legislature passed and enacted into law that did not have action from the UI task force?
The governor's $350 million tax adjustment. It wasn't really a tax cut because it was scheduled to happen anyways. They moved up the dates. Also, the locked out workers provision. So I was curious. I mean, I don't believe you gave that same speech on that bill either. I mean, this is when you the advisory council in the past, there was another bill last year that didn't go through the council that wasn't opposed. I mean, this is a lot different than the workers' comp council, which actually there is a unique agreement between the AFL-CIO and the chamber where bills don't get heard unless it goes through there. There is a this is just what it is. It's advisory. And so there's a lot of bills that move outside of it.
So, Mr. Gerber, why was last year's tax cut okay to go through the UI, to not go through the UI Advisory Task Force, but this one, it's not okay for this to avoid the UI Task Force?
Mr. Chair, you'd have to ask DEED staff that question.
Representative Isaacson, you want to crack at it first before I ask staff?
Well, I'm not sure that I think it was a good idea either way at the end, and I'm going to go ahead and freely play my freshman card as I learn how this process works and let you know that I'm learning as we go. But I would argue that if we have a council whose job actually has the word advisory in the title, perhaps we should take that into consideration that's there for a reason, and maybe we don't have to rush to something. Mr. Gerber presents a position that subsumes that this is a paramount pressure that needs to happen right now, and that if the other group likes it, they should do something about it if they don't like his plan. And I don't know that that's an arguing position to come from, because he's not an elected official with represented power. And so that doesn't really flow with me that way. And so what I would say is, if we're going to have a look at this, let's have a look at this through the advisory committee, whose job as it is to advise us on these things. I mean, I'm not saying the past precedent was perfect, but we doesn't have to go forward and do stupid things to further.
Mr. Caligiuri, before I go to Representative Gunther, so why the discrepancy? Why was that one okay, but this one isn't?
Mr. Chair, members, with the last there, that was a governor's initiative. It started out as a governor's initiative.
I have the answer I need. Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that whether we're going to go in recession or not is somewhat forecasted by management and budget, and they listen to read Dee's literature all the time that I get on a daily basis. It points a very rosy picture. I don't think, according to them, we're going to do nothing but grow and our economy is going to improve. In fact, it improves at a rate level that is anticipated by 2017 that the UI surplus, if not disseminated back to the businesses, who might use it to grow and create more jobs. It might be up to $1.7 billion instead of 1.4 or under 1.4. We are going at a low ebb right now, so the trust fund should be a low. If you wait till the growth comes, it should be there. And furthermore, I've been on advisory council long enough that I remember when we thought having $700 million was just fine, and we didn't have problems. Now the advisory council, in their wisdom, came with a rapid recovery system that will prevent us from having to pay too much of a penalty or interest to the federal government, and I'm very proud of the time that I was there to vote for that, and you should have been too. And I think what we're really doing is we're trying to stop this extra bloat of these funds that could be spent by our business people to hire more of Jennifer's employees and pay them higher wages. And I think that's what we're stopping here by not having this. I think management and budget forecast, I pay a lot of attention to that. And I read every one of Kim Babine's letters she sends me. And I think this is very much in line, and I think it's something that we should do.
Next representative got there. Representative Scott and Swazinski.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swazinski.
Pass.
Representative Simonson and Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my questions are for Mr. Gerber. We're way in the weeds here on this bill, and we're trying to figure out things that I don't think we should be trying to figure out, especially when we have an advisory council, as Representative Eisenstein so eloquently put, and thank you for that. But my question is for you, because I don't understand why, when we have this UI advisory council, why it is that you're not using them. And I'm of the presumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this bill is coming from your organization. I don't think that this is Representative Smith's brainchild. I think that this comes from the chamber. And if you could just tell me why it is that we are opposed to running this through the advisory council.
And if Mr. Galagiri could answer the question a second time about why we didn't do it last time, I want to hear that too. I think so. Representative Simonson, we kind of answered that issue. Do you just want to address that point for me about why? Is there something I don't know besides the fact that the governor proposed it last time? Is there any other variable?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know that there's another variable other than the fact that it was the governor's recommendation. I don't think we can argue that. And in that case, the department wasn't opposed to it. But in this case, this bill, I'm hearing we have opposition from the department. We have opposition from representative of the AFL-CIO, the workers. And I'm just wondering why. And I wasn't on the jobs committee 2 years ago, so I didn't get a chance to answer that question. And maybe there is a better answer out there. But for today's purposes, I guess I want to know why.
All right, Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I did actually bring this idea up with DEED staff. There was another organization that wanted something as a, you know, almost like a trade. We couldn't work that out, and so it didn't make sense to bring that to the advisory council, just as the groups before didn't bring their bill to the advisory council because they knew that it wouldn't actually go through the process. So and again, this is different than the Work Comp Advisory Council, where bills have to go through there. There's no you know, tacit agreement between different parties. The other question that you asked too is, you know, why didn't the governor's piece? Well, I believe, and Rick could correct me if I'm wrong, that the advisory council's bill goes to the governor's office as part of the UI bill and becomes, you know, essentially almost like the governor's bill. So I'm not sure. You know, why that couldn't have also gone through the process.
Well, we'll come back to, I see both of you want to say something. We'll come back in a second. Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Gerber, I'm not positive you answered the question there, but is your membership, do you have a seat on the UI Advisory Council?
Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Gerber, I mean, don't you think it's a little disingenuous to the council that you are bringing forward a bill that obviously there's significant opposition to from various stakeholders. I mean, what does the advisory council, what purpose does it serve then if we're not going to use it and we have one of their own members, a sitting member of the council, bringing forward a bill that hasn't been vetted by the council?
Mr. Gerber, I'm going to have you answer the question, but I think I'm right on this issue that there actually is not that much controversy, that people agree that we should have some sort of mechanism to reduce these rates. I don't think there's a lot to fight about here. And I'm pretty sure about that, but Mr. Gerber, you can answer the question if you want.
Mr. Chair, I think you're right.
Okay. The other two testifiers, did you have any comments, David?
Mr. Chair.
Hold on. Let me get to them, and I'll get back to you, Representative Simons.
Mr. Chair, I would disagree. This was brought before the UI Advisory Council 2 years ago, and it did not have it didn't have support, let's just put it that way. And I want to address the fact that it's not just giving money back. It is changing the tax structure of our UI trust fund. Not just putting a cap on it, it's changing the tax structure. This could cause it, just cause a lot of problems. So without Deed and the folks that are the experts on how the mechanisms work and the tax structure, without them vetting this and doing, you know, making sure that this isn't going to do some serious harm to our trust fund. And I want to address Mr. Gerber's comments about the locked out workers. And I will sit up here and say that I'm proud that we did not. We gave the UI Advisory Council notice that we would be moving that bill for our locked out workers in one of the worst recessions where they were losing their homes and their families and it ruined a community. And we fought for them to get UI benefits.
Okay,
but they were not in support.
So Representative Smith just joined the legislature. How was this proposal brought forward 2 years ago to the UI task force?
Mr. Chair, the chamber.
Mr. Gerber, did you have this proposal 2 years ago?
That would be news to me, Mr. Chair. I never brought this forward. So I've served on the council for longer than that, and I've never seen this bill.
Representative Smith, 2 years ago, before you were in the legislature, did you author a UI proposal I didn't know about?
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay, so was there a different proposal that perhaps you thought was...
There was, Mr. Chair, there was a proposal that was brought forward to reduce the tax. I know that House Research is getting the notes.
Okay. Mr. Caligiuri, did you have anything to add before we go back to Representative Simonson?
Mr. Chair, nothing other than the first tax decrease did not permanently alter the tax structure. So that's the major objection we have here. This is going in and altering the system and altering the structure.
Okay.
There are probably other ways to do it.
Parliamentary inquiry?
No. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you very skillfully gave me a couple minutes to think. Appreciate that. But I do want the record to show that the questions that I asked were not answered by Mr. Gerber, and that's a little bit frustrating. But to your point, Mr. Chair, I don't know that this is a controversial issue either. What I'm uncomfortable with is the process in which we're following, and I can't compare it to what happened 2 years ago. Yes, I was here, but I have no idea how the process played out 2 years ago. So in all due respect, I'm just trying to look at this particular process and what we're doing, and I'm a little bit concerned. But I'm going to try, Mr. Gerber, to ask you one more question. And if you could tell me when this advisory council next meets.
Mr. Gerber, and then we're going to go to Gunther, Baker, Mahoney, Metza, and O'Neill. Mr. Gerber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, it usually meets in the fall three times on a Tuesday afternoon, so I'm assuming sometime in 2015, which will be too late to do anything about the over $200 million more dollars that will be in the fund than we would even need under the federal government's own advisement.
Representative Gunther.
I'm fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Baker, Mahoney, Metza, and O'Neill, unless people want to beat this horse anymore.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chairman.
Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Gallagher, sorry about that. Did you say earlier that kind of the low point of the fund through the year is usually the end of March, March 31st?
And first of all, Mr. Caligiuri, am I saying your name right?
That you are.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri.
I butchered it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Historically, on an annual basis, yes, that would be the low point, March, end of March.
Okay.
Winter payouts happen before the first quarter revenue comes in.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, so today's March 11th, and you're at $1.4 billion now?
$1.3.
Mr. Caligiuri.
Okay.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, I guess I kind of see the need for the discussion at this point. I do think that our elected official, Representative Dennis Smith, has the ability and the prerogative to bring it to his body, which he's doing with this, like the governor did when he had the prerogative to do that there. Whether this passes or fails is based on the, you know, basically the convincing argument that we think this is a healthy fund. I think as an employer myself, I want this to be a healthy fund. I don't ever want to see us borrow money. But if we're at 1.3 now, at close to the most intense time of that fund, this is not a bad time to be talking about this. So I guess I applaud your ability to bring this to us today, Representative Smith, and I think this is a good thing to talk about, and it's a good thing to act upon, and our state does react quickly with a good formula. And again, I think maybe this fall, I would encourage the Minnesota Chamber and the rest of the advisory board to discuss it, to make sure that going further, we've got good numbers going forward and good safety nets. So I would support this. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney, and then Metza, then O'Neill.
There's a couple things I want to say. When Representative Rabinovich brought the tax cut to the committee, I made it a point to pick up the phone and call all the people involved, Mr. Caligiuri, Mr. Gerber. I won't mention other names, but you know, I know most of the people on that particular committee, the UI committee, and they all supported that. So I did not find, yes, it did not go through the advisory committee, but it was certainly vetted in the most available method to me through the committee. And on top of that, I think, yes, there is still time that if the parties can come together, they can come up with a number that might work and work better. Because every time the fund goes into deficit, the businesses of the state of Minnesota are paying interest on top of their taxes to the federal government. So we need to be aware of that. But I will tell you, even in a minor recession, our UI fund goes into debt and borrows from the federal government. And the fact that you want to not pay the interest any longer than you possibly can is good fiscal management. But I still think there should be some room for a cap. My concern, though, with this bill, and I had looked at this bill a number of different times, my biggest concern is if you go to the fiscal note, it has a substantial effect on the Workforce Development Fund. $3.5 million in 16, almost $7 million in 17, again in 18 the same, ongoing pretty much $7 million. And members, and I'm concerned about that because the Workforce Development Fund is a dollar figure that we use to fill the hole of training workers. So I'm more concerned about that particular piece, really, than the UI fund, because that's kind of above my, it's not above my pay grade, it's just beyond my pay grade, as I think we've all noticed. But that's an issue that is of concern to me, and it should be a concern to the chair, because if those millions of dollars are out of there, you have to backfill that in some other way in terms of how you're going to spend the money on workforce training. So that's something you need to ask deeper questions on, because I don't really know all the answers to that, sir.
Thank you, Representative Mahoney. Representative Metza, then O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few closing things to say on the argument or debate here. You know, I'm fine with finding some middle ground. I was working with Representative Mahoney on the Jobs Committee previously and did, you know, want to learn about this process. My community goes through these ups and downs more often than anyone else in the state. I feel safe saying that without knowing the facts, but I can guess that we do. And, you know, we're talking about this as the business's money. In my mind, this is the people's money who worked, and it goes into this account for them to utilize up until the point that we realize their jobs are okay. They aren't getting laid off. And then it caps out, goes back. We've got a good system in place. Let's not keep in the weeds here and get something together that all your friends can agree with here and take it up when it's got peace in the valley.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Clark, we're going to get to your bill, I promise. It's going to happen eventually.
I will be very brief. I apologize for coming late. I had another bill hearing because that committee continued to run late and their members continued to talk like here. So, in any case, I also serve on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, Representative Isaacson, and to specifically to Representative Simonson's point about the UI Council meeting or not meeting, I'm just curious because I was under the understanding, being on the council, that we met four times, but I know Ben Gerber just said three. But I thought we actually ended a little bit early. That was my recollection the last couple times. But Mr. Caligiuri, was there ever a question about whether we can meet again and talk about this? I mean, was that ever posed to you so that we could actually convene and have all this kind of discussed in advance? Because I would have loved to talk about all this there instead of here. Was that ever posed to you?
Mr. Caligiuri.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, the last 2 or 3 years, we scheduled four meetings. And we get those on everybody's schedule, and then we finish when we finish. If we finish after the second meeting or the third meeting and they've gone through all the issues, then we don't meet anymore. So this past year, we scheduled four meetings, and we concluded after the third meeting. And I was actually expecting Ben to bring it to the council at that third meeting, because we had discussed it over the phone, and it didn't happen.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So, Mr. Caligiuri, did he ask you maybe after? I mean, I don't see what would prohibit us from meeting that fourth time, but maybe a month later or 2 months later. Did he ever ask you to convene so that we could discuss this properly in the Uninsurance Advisory Committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, he did ask if we could convene a special meeting, and we conferred on that, and there were a number of issues at play, and it was just impractical to do it at that time after the season of the meetings had ended.
Representative O'Neill?
Well, I think I would have been willing. I think Representative Gunther would have been willing. I would have been willing. I'm sure many at the table would have been willing to come back and seriously look at this, because especially after the MMB report, you know, February forecast was pretty rosy, as Representative Gunther just pointed out. And, you know, if we're going to have $1.7, $1.8 billion in January 2017, that's a pretty healthy fund. I mean, that's quite a bit of money in there. And I would have loved to come and talk about this in the advisory council and then move forward. I really hope that would have been the path instead of where we ended up here. But maybe now that we're here, maybe the two of you can really discuss this, because I would think that $1.7 billion, $1.8 billion, wherever we think the fund's going to be with this very, very rosy MMB report by January of 2017, I would think that would be something that we'd want to seriously look at.
And Representative Smith, I think the lesson of the day is when you bring treats, you don't want to sugar up the committee. This is what happens. So, Representative Smith, do you have any closing comments for your bill?
Mr. Chair, at least sugar-free treats next time. I appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill and to look at the trust fund and to bring the level to a reasonable level. I remind the committee, this is not precedent setting. There are senators that have signed their name to this bill that are on the advisory council. So this is bipartisan support, and I respectfully ask the committee's support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Smith renews his motion to have House File 402 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Or whatever number it was. Sorry. I'll say it again because House File 1416. Thank you.
Representative Clark, my apologies for keeping your constituents, and I did try to move things along. I tried, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill. It's my actually first housing bill before this committee this year. And I having an amendment passed out, and Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence. We had an amendment that is in everybody's packets, and I've had some conversations with a couple of folks today, including the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency and some others, who asked us to tweak it a little bit more. So the amendment you're getting right now, with your approval, it does change that existing amendment just a little bit, not substantially, but just makes things a little clearer. So, with your permission, I would like to move that the A1 amendment be.
Representative Clark moves that House File 335 be considered for possible inclusion in a later bill. And members, we are on the A1 amendment. I was going to grant. Let's see, the A1 amendment is after our deadline, but again, we're laying this bill over, and I think it's pretty clear what the amendment does. Is there any objections from members of the committee if the chair waives that rule? I'm inclined to do so without objection, so that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to waive the rule. So, did someone say something?
Me.
Representative Scott, what's wrong?
Are you going to have discussion on the amendment?
Yes, Representative Scott, we will have discussion. So Representative Clark moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like.
You want me to explain the amendment separate from the bill or just as we go through? If I could do it as we go through, it'll make more sense, I think.
Usually we let authors make amendments. So all in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. And now Representative Clark, if you could speak to
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
335 as amended.
Yes, House File 335 as amended. It requests that the state fund a two-year transitional rental voucher pilot program to serve women who are victims of domestic violence and have children with them and are at risk of becoming homeless. This is a program that was designed and brought to me by members of the Asian Pacific Council, and it was designed with Asian and emerging ethnic communities. I want to make it clear, and I think the amendment makes it even clearer, that the program will be accessible to victims regardless of their race. So that's part of the reason why the language is a little bit changed to make it even clearer than the original amendment, that this is available regardless of race. And that was some concern that was raised by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. They wanted me to make that a little bit clearer. Mr. Chairman, that's the main part of that amendment. So what the background on this is a little bit to tell you, domestic violence is a leading cause of homelessness among women and children today. And there was a study done by the U.S. Conference of Mayors in 2006, and 44% of the cities surveyed identified domestic violence as the primary cause of homelessness among families. And so this is a way to help deal with that. It also talks about other forms of gender violence. And the point here is that when victims need to leave their homes, they do not have to become homeless. This is a particular concern in the Asian community, and we'll hear some testimony. Because the cultural values in that community make it clear, people do not access homeless shelters. Just don't use those shelters for a number of reasons that have to do with culture. And so it's not an option. So what we're proposing here is a limited voucher program that will enable people to get transitional housing, and it's a pilot that I think we'll be able to test and will serve us very well. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to ask some of our witnesses to come forward, and we can talk some more about details, like how many families will be served and all that, but I thought maybe we should go ahead and hear some more of the background for this testimony from our witnesses. So the first witness here is Claudia Bori, who's an executive director of Asian Women United.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Claudia Waring. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Representative Clark, thank you for your leadership in introducing this bill. I'm here to provide a little bit of information on who might benefit from this bill. I've been the executive director of Asian Women United of Minnesota for about 4.5 years, and Asian Women United, which we often shorten to AWOM, and that's how I'll talk about us, provides emergency shelter support and advocacy to women who aim to live violence-free lives. Over 90% of the women who come to our shelter, which we call House of Peace, are Asian, and they represent the diversity of the API community in Minnesota. And of those women, a majority are relatively recent immigrants and refugees. Now, most nights, the House of Peace is full of women and children who have been uprooted from their homes and are uncertain about where they will go after their shelter stay expires. In a typical year, A1 provides shelter to between 100 and 125 women and children, and in addition, we provide community advocacy services such as crisis calls and community-based consultation to about 1,000 additional individuals. On average, over 700 requests for shelter are unmet because the shelter is full or because the caller is screened out. In other words, it is determined that the person is not suffering immediate danger or domestic abuse at this moment, but is in fact homeless. Every day we receive calls from mothers who are in desperate need of stable housing and fear what will occur if they take their children to a conventional homeless shelter. I want to share with you that several babies are born at House of Peace each year. Women come to shelter when pregnant, deliver their babies, and return to shelter with infants in arms. House of Peace is the first home for many of our babies and may be the only stable home they have for some months once they leave shelter. A typical House of Peace resident has undergone profound levels of abuse, physical and emotional. The next step for her and her children must be a safe and secure place to live. And ideally, they would depart shelter to homes of their own, but this is a relatively rare occurrence. I believe that you received a pie chart. It just provides a quick snapshot of where the roughly 100 women we served in shelter in 2013 ended up. And if you take just a quick glance at that, you can see that only 5% of the women that we served that year were able to access and enter transitional housing. And upwards of 65 to 70% entered a sort of a tenuous shelter situation following their stay. Many of you already know this, but common barriers faced by immigrant and refugee battered women include low English proficiency, no work history in the United States, lack of driver's license, and no credit history. Many women face so many barriers that their stays at shelter are lengthy, longer than 45 days. Yesterday afternoon, I listened to an advocate share her frustration that a shelter resident was declined from what had appeared to be a promising transitional housing placement because, according to the staff person, the woman would require an interpreter to participate in meetings and on-site programming. Other residents from AWOM have been rejected from mainstream housing programs for that same reason. Advocates have become discouraged from submitting applications on behalf of women who are not fluent or nearly fluent in English, or who have too many children, or have other barriers that seem insurmountable in the face of program requirements. This is why AWOM supports legislation that would dedicate resources to providing safe, affordable housing specifically to immigrant and refugee women and children. 20 years ago, our foremothers founded AWOM on the principle that while existing mainstream battered women's services were excellent, they were not culturally comprehensive. And as most people know, homelessness, whether literally on the streets, in a homeless shelter, or through overcrowding with family or friends, exposes women and children to the risk of more abuse, insecurity, and hopelessness. We need to support these women so they can raise their children in peace, so they are not compelled to return to abusive homes or compromise their welfare because no other options exist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Or are you going to testify? Or? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, next witness is Deputy Todd Milburn from the Brooklyn Park Police Department.
Could have used your help during the previous debate, officer.
Suddenly law enforcement's not so complicated.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Deputy Chief Todd Milburn with the Brooklyn Park Police Department. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak here tonight. On behalf of the mayor of the city of Brooklyn Park, I'm pleased to show our support for this bill before your committee. I'd like to highlight some important and brief information about the city of Brooklyn Park as it relates to our crime reduction strategies and ongoing efforts to reducing the number of domestic abuse incidents in the city of Brooklyn Park. Approximately 5 years ago, Brooklyn Park Police Department restructured and adopted a new police philosophy
The philosophy incorporates intelligence-led police models and drives staff towards engaging the community. That work has paid off, even though the population has steadily increased by over 25,000 over the last 20 years. Overall crime has continued to drop over that same time period. The police department and city council work together to enhance our collective response towards domestic abuse cases as well. The creation of the Brooklyn Park Domestic Violence Reduction Project has changed our approach on how we prevent and solve domestic abuse-related crimes. This project and our staff have connected victims to more resources, created procedural changes in how we investigate these crimes, and strengthened their prosecutions. Much of this work has led to a conviction rate increase of 240% for domestic abuse crimes from 2010 to 2014. Despite our best efforts, however, we still have problems that are difficult to overcome, particularly in our Asian community. Brooklyn Park is the most diverse community in the entire state. 18% of our overall population is Asian American. In 2014, Brooklyn Park Police handled over 500 domestic abuse cases. Our Asian American population accounted for 8 of those domestic abuse cases, or 1.5%. By comparison, domestic abuse reported in our African American community was at 65%. Because of this low percentage of reporting in our Asian American community and other anecdotal information received, we believe that the Asian American population is underreporting domestic-related problems. As an example, oftentimes we see victims in the Asian community obtain order for protections against the abuser only to discover afterwards that no police report exists. We believe that in many of these cases, victims elect to not report to police and deal with the domestic abuse problems within the family dynamic as part of their strong cultural beliefs and customs. And unfortunately, many of the victims in these cases will simply return to the environment only to become subjected to further abuse. Asian American victims of domestic abuse are reluctant to reach out to authorities in a time of crisis. Once we are contacted, we have the capacity to solve the crimes and connect victims with adequate resources in the very early stages of a crisis. We need to create more opportunities for these victims to feel safe, and the state can help with that. Providing a rental assistance program which would allow victims of domestic abuse to leave the abusive environment is one such way that we can break the cycle of violence. We respectfully ask for your support of this bill to allow police and other organizations to find safe options for these victims and their children who feel trapped in abusive relationships and have nowhere to turn. Thank you for your consideration of this matter.
Thank you. Representative Clark, do you have one more testifier?
One more, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Abibu Benson.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
B. Vu Benson. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for this opportunity to speak in front of you. My name is B. Vu Benson. I am a survivor of domestic violence, and I'm also the therapist on site at the Asian Women United of Minnesota shelter. Over the five years that I worked with the women and children who have been negatively impacted mentally, physically, spiritually, and economically by domestic violence, sexual assaults, sex trafficking, international abuse in marriages, and forced cultural marriages. When they come to the shelter, these women and children have left behind nearly all of their personal belongings and their homes. Without the Asian Women United Shelter in Minnesota and other shelters in this area, they would be homeless. Shelter becomes the new and stable home for the families. However, it is only a short-lived home. Today, I want to share with you briefly the story of a survivor who has given us permission to share her story at this committee hearing. Maiku, not her real name, is a young woman from Laos. She was 20 years old when she met a 56-year-old Hmong American man traveling in Laos. During their courtship, he mentioned that he was previously married but had no children. He told her that he loved her and would care for her. He met her family and sought their permission to marry her. Gradually, she fell in love with him and agreed to marry him, believing he was an honorable man. When Maiku arrived in Minnesota, however, she quickly saw that her husband was still living with the first wife. She realized that she was brought to the United States to be a second wife and to bear children for them. During the 5 years that she stayed with this couple, she was not allowed to attend school, learn English, or work outside the home. Moreover, the husband did not complete the necessary immigration paperwork to allow her to stay legally in the U.S. and eventually apply for citizenship. Maiku was pregnant year after year with little to stay in the marriage. She endured 5 years of sexual exploitation, physical abuse, and emotional trauma. She was isolated from her relatives. Her own children, who were ages 4, 3, and 1, were forbidden to address her as mother. Instead, the first wife was their mother. When Maiku discovered herself pregnant with the fourth child, she finally found the courage to leave this abusive relationship. She was attending a family funeral when she asked someone for help, and that person dropped her off at the Asian Women United shelter. While there, she received help from legal aid to obtain an order for protection, file for divorce, and complete her immigration application. She became a legal resident in the United States after 1 year of this process. During her stay at the shelter, Maiku applied for over 15 different transitional and public housing programs and did not receive any housing support. She ended up taking shelter with a relative's family. 4 years later, she is still moving from one crowded house to another with no stable housing for her young children or herself. Her sources of income include child support, food assistance, and a part-time low-wage job, but she still cannot afford to rent her own place. Maiku says she is grateful to the state of Minnesota for providing domestic violence shelter and other supportive services such as mental health and legal aid services for her and other victims like her. She is thankful to this committee for hearing House File 335. As a therapist who has worked closely with women like Maiku and many others in similar situations of exploitation and abuse, I have witnessed every single one of them experiencing enormous, enormous difficulty finding affordable housing. Why? Why is that so? Number one, they have limited income or no income at all and cannot make their monthly rent payments. Some of them cannot even afford the security deposit in the first place. Number two, because of their low income or underemployment, many landlords require that the women pay in advance not only the security deposit, but 2 months of rent. 2 months of rent before they can sign the lease. If a rental unit costs $900 a month, the woman has to come up with $2,700 before she can sign the agreement. How is a woman with 4 children and an income of less than $900 or a little more able to come up with $2,700 to pay for her rent? And thirdly, it is plain and simple that there is a shortage of affordable housing in our state. Moreover, as Claudia stated, the current transitional and subsidized housing programs have layers of program requirements that make them inaccessible to Asian women and children and other immigrant victims. We need more financial resources to fund rental assistance programs and supportive services for these exploited women and children. The housing assistance programs we currently have are not adequate to serve our most vulnerable women and children in the state. I urge you to support and fund House File 335. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments from members of the committee for any of our testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Clark, do you have any closing comment? Oh, Representative Mahoney, my apologies.
No, Mr. Chair. Having a large Asian population in my district, I won't relay some of the stories about the domestic abuse and the cultural problems that women trying to leave those situations have publicly anyhow, and if anyone cares to hear some of them are pretty heart-wrenching. I wholeheartedly support this bill, and I hope we can do something for this particular group.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's support for this bill. It is a need that is real, and I think you've heard some specific examples of it. And again, this is pilot demonstration project that we think will serve very well as part of our community that really is not being served now. And it's especially important for the women and children that it represents.
Thank you, Representative Clark. With that, Representative Clark renews her motion to have House File 335 as amended laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Chair moves House File 872 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 872 is relevant to net operating loss marketplace. I have a brief overview, and then I'm going to turn over the rest of the time that is allotted to us to Genevieve Blumador for further elaboration. Minnesota's economy, as we all know, has long benefited from a strong research-based initiative based on corporations such as Medtronic, 3M, Boston Scientific, and St. Jude Medical. Companies emerging with the cutting-edge technologies today are small startups that are facing an uphill battle for crucial early-stage funding needed to bring the next life-saving therapy to reality for all of us. Net operating loss marketplace bill is a genuinely unique idea that could potentially infuse capital in those early-stage companies during this crucial period in their development in order to provide Minnesota with a continuation of the strong med tech corporations that we enjoy in this marketplace. With that, Mr. Chair, I will reserve the rest of my time for Ms. Plumador.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Genevieve Plumador. I'm here on behalf of Life Science Alley, and I thank you for the opportunity to come to speak to you about this very unique program that we hope to bring here to Minnesota to help bolster the development of our small med tech companies. As you know, Minnesota has one of the most robust and highly concentrated medical technology hubs in the world, so much so that the Smithsonian Museum this year out in D.C. is going to be unveiling their Places of Innovation exhibit, and Minnesota's Medical Alley will be one of those places of innovation. So innovative programs like this will help to ensure that our legacy will continue to be our future in this space. So how does the program work? Currently, a company can carry forward their NOLs, or net operating losses, to a taxable year in the future when they have an actual tax liability. Under this program, a biotechnology company can transfer or sell its unused NOLs for cash to be reinvested in operations that same taxable year. A profitable company can then purchase those NOLs at a discount on an online marketplace. The only other state that has this innovative program is New Jersey, because they too have a significant med tech hub found in the pharmaceutical industry. In the 10-year study that New Jersey did a few years ago, they compiled some research and found that they actually made money in the 10 years that the program had been instituted in that state, because companies were able to inject capital into their companies immediately that taxable year in the form of wages, equipment purchases, et cetera, and then they become profitable faster and therefore pay taxes much sooner because they're not able to use those NOLs that once they become profitable. So again, this would be a groundbreaking program here in Minnesota. When I talk to our members about ideas how we can ensure that Minnesota remains a med tech hub, this is one of those creative ideas that our companies get excited about, and it's the type of program that really would make us very competitive in comparison to some of the other states. So again, the NOL marketplace would be a very powerful economic development tool, and I hope has the support of the committee.
Representative Albright, do you have any other testifiers?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comment portion of the bill and go to members' questions. Representative Swazinski, Scott, and Mahoney. Representative
Swazinski. I'll pass.
Representative Scott.
Oh, I'll pass.
Representative Mahoney.
I guess people just like to hear me talk. Or is it me that likes to hear myself talk?
I think it's the latter.
I'm just having a question for Representative Albright. Do you think most of this will happen between, say, Eden Prairie and Maple Grove, or do you think the whole state might benefit from this?
Representative Albright, I didn't hear the question. Do I want to have him restated or not?
No.
Are there any other questions for members of the committee?
Sure, I'm quite familiar with Representative Mahoney's desire to encourage out-state growth, but also not disenfranchise those in the Eden Prairie MedTech. I think that in the marketplace for ideas and for opportunities, the whole state would share in this program, and I would advocate for the entire of the state to participate in this, not just based upon what we see in the metro area. Thank you.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 870. Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really do have a question. Is there a fiscal note to this since it deals with tax credits?
By a revenue note, Representative Albright?
Yes, there is. It was issued, I believe, last week. And I don't have it with my packet, but I do believe it was provided to the committee.
Representative Scott?
I'm just wondering if... Oh. I've got my information here from DFL staff.
In fairness, Representative Scott, it's a revenue note, which is not the purview of this committee. That's why you don't have it.
We just get revenue out.
Yeah, just teasing. Thank you.
With that, the chair renews his motion to have House File 872 recommended to pass and referred to the tax committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. And the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gunther, you're the final bill on the agenda, House File 519. Well, it appears that the Representative Scott, it appears that the Republican research brief has that information contained in it.
Oh my goodness!
So
maybe
you know. But I guess in order to know that, you would have to read the research summary, yes. Representative Scott. So, oh snap! Oh yeah! All right, Representative Gunther.
Mr. Chairman, I will move House File 519 to be passed and sent to taxes.
Yeah. No, I think we're laying it over for...
Leave it over for... Let me look. That's even better.
No, we're going to taxes. My apologies. Representative Gunther moves that House File 519 be recommended to pass and referred to the tax committee. My apologies.
And to speed this process on, I will not have my opening remarks. We'll leave Genevieve Pomador talk about the program.
Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Genevieve Pomador here again with Life Science Alley. I'll keep it brief. I know the committee is very familiar with the successes of this program. So just to reiterate, this would help to ensure that this program keeps us very competitive in comparison to some of the other states in which companies that we represent at Life Science Alley do business in. Minnesota took very important steps back in 2010 to institute this credit, and as we've seen time and time again, it has continued to be depleted faster and faster. And so we are very supportive of additional monies coming into this tax credit, and continue to be supportive of the split between the greater Minnesota minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, split that's in Chair Gunther's bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record.
John Dukic with the Minnesota High Tech Association, and I don't need to reiterate or repeat what Genevieve said, but we are in support of this bill.
Thank you. Representative Gunther, any other testifiers?
No.
All right. This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns of the bill? Seeing none, all those, that will close the public comment portion of the bill and move to members' questions. Any questions from members of the committee? That's so fetch. That's so good. That's so fetch. Representatives, does anyone get that reference? No? No? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question for Master Dukic. He's related to a friend of ours. Just wondering how Joey's doing.
That's fair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so Joey is my cousin, and as far as I know, he's doing well. We saw him at Christmas, and...
All right.
Great.
All right, thanks. With that, Representative Gunther renews his motion to have House File 519 be recommended to pass and refer to the Tax Committee. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. You're on your way to taxes. Members, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.